Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's February 3rd, 2012. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long, and I'm happy I am doing it via Skype today.
You don't want to see what pretty colors I'm coughing up this week?
You do not sound well today, partner.
Yeah, I got, that's what happens when you have little ones running around the house, and they're hacking and sneezing from whatever they got from daycare. They hack and sneeze it on you, and even though I got the flu shot this year and everything, I still caught this head cold, so not good.
See, that's why I live in a bubble.
Yep, I wish I did.
And just roll around the house in the bubble, and I'm always perfectly healthy when I'm on the show. Never sneezing, coughing, or anything.
But at least yours are allergies, though.
This hand of the week is becoming our new hot topic for the show. You know, things go ebb and flow. Sometimes the hotline's hot. Sometimes the main topic's hot. Sometimes the mailbag's hot. And all of a sudden, the hand of the week seems to be what people are all congealing around.
Yeah, it's our flavor of the month.
We had that great Queen Deuce hand a couple shows ago that got everybody fired up. And then, last week we had the caller that suggested maybe we take a more systematic approach to breaking down the hand of the week because, you know, we're prone to go off on tangents and offer, you know, more than we should of our absolutely terrible advice, right? So the forum was alive with that this week too at anteupmagazine.com/forum. Generally speaking, most people said, no, hey, we listen to the show because you guys are just absolutely idiots in the hand of the week. Don't change a thing. Hey, great, thanks, I think. And then one of our listeners sent us probably the best email of 2012 already, set the bar pretty high for the rest of the folks out there. David Smith from Lafayette, Colorado. Shot us his email and said that, you know, hey, he had to agree with the caller last week, looking for some structure for the hand of the week. And he knew, obviously, that we were woefully incapable of doing that ourselves. Right?
Yeah.
So he actually took some time and put together a template for us to use for future hands of the week. And he even sent us a Microsoft Word version of it so we can edit it if we need to. But I think it's pretty good the way it is. David obviously put a lot of thought on this. We kind of spilled the beans on the forum with our red. I think it's getting high praise there.
Was I the only one who had flashbacks to like my third grade book report of Red Badge of Courage?
No. This is exactly what I thought of when I saw he's got Roman numerals in here. I haven't seen that since I've seen Rocky. and then you've got letters and little eyes and numbers and, you know, I feel like that college comp paper.
Yeah.
In high school, and no one writes like that anymore. But David Smith does.
It's like a syllabus.
And you can tell, obviously, you can tell the people that are very organized. And those are the people that want us to be very organized for the hand of the week. And David, obviously, is very organized because they actually probably do this stuff in their real life. And that's why they're organized, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They got Roman numerals and little A's and little I's attached to everything they do.
I was impressed that he knew that the I goes before the V when he means four, so...
Yes.
He's really, using his Roman numeral muscle there.
We have several professionals that listen to the show. Not professional players, but just professionals in their profession. All right, so we're going to get through this pretty quickly, but we're going to start with Roman number one. Read the hand of the week.
Pretty simple.
Never had trouble with that, right?
That's pretty simple.
Letter A, try to limit the superfluous, unnecessary information. Who cares if they, quote, built it up? Just tell us the stack sizes unless there's something relevant. And he says, this is for the heroes also, too. See, thank you. He's got my back there because, you know, we just kind of read it the way it comes in usually. Hey, you know, the heroes want to, like, talk about building it up. Hey, you know.
I have to say that I'm on his side with this. This is good. I agree with this.
All right. Roman numeral 1, letter B. We'll call the hero's hand X, and this is just, you know, for the going forward, the rest of the, you know, the legalese stuff, you know.
Right.
From here on out, the plaintiff. Instead of Scott Lark. And C, Chris, who'll be going by C now, and or Scott, S. Should make fun of any cheesy names for the given hand, X.
Well, I could see, like, abbreviating the hero's name because it's more than one syllable, but if Chris and Scott are just one syllables, then why does substituting C or S make a difference?
Well, it's just for the typing here. I don't think
For him. Okay. So it makes it easier on him.
Yeah, he's not trying to change our names here. We're not going by McGee now. But,
okay. I want to be known as C-Cause.
C-Cause. All right. We'll work on that. I used to go by Scolo.
Skolo. How low can you go?
All right, moving on to Roman numeral 2. See, we're getting through this pretty quickly.
All right, good.
Roman numeral 2, the pre-flop analysis.
Okay.
A, first, C and or S, explain why hero should have folded X.
That's if the hand's not playable, I guess. So.
That's true, because then letter B is, if the hand is actually playable, and lots of italics in this one, by the way. If the hand is actually playable, we go to little I, C and S try to find reasons for playing X. Two, they are double I. They should mention at least two of the following. Now we're into little tiny numbers. One, something about position. Two, raise or fold, don't call. Three, if they are connected or suited. And four, quote, making a play. I think he knows this pretty well, doesn't he?
This is so easy. You could just follow this flow chart and always return back to where you have to go. So I'm wondering, too, if we can actually go back in. You know, you can't go back in time, but you can go back in phases, too. You know, I mean, I wonder if this is stuff that can help us later on in the hand as well. I like this.
Okay. All right. Well, we're moving on now. Now we're on Roman numeral 3, flop analysis. By the way, he says it's mandatory to say rainbow if all three cards are different suits. Letter A, C or S say, this is why you don't play X. B, analyze situation using at least three of the following. Some math is always impressive. Something about position. Raise or fold, don't call. Try to put villains on a range of hands. Discuss bet sizing.
We already do all these things.
Well, yeah, he's just trying to get us. You know, he's not saying we're not doing these things. He's just trying to get us focused. This is our palette to paint with here.
Okay.
All right, remember, because we get off on these tangents and we talk about stuff. So, you know, he's keeping us focused here.
All right, I agree.
Roman numeral 4, turn and river analysis. Basically following the similar steps to flop for each of the last streets. A, critique the hero's usually passive play on the last street. CRS say, this is why you don't play X. At some point, CRS says, well, this is a hand of the week, so. D, analyze situation using at least three of the following. Some math is always impressive. Something about position. Raise or fold, don't call. Try to put villains on a range of hands. Discuss butt sizing.
Did you say discuss butt sizing?
Yeah, well, you know, hey, I got to have a little fun with the hand of the week, right? They're going to strip all the fun out of it here.
Well, the size of his butt was really big, so I had an idea that he sat there for a really long time. So that means he was a rock, so I think he was tight, so I'm beat on the river. Butt sizing tells the whole story.
Oh, man. All right, Roman numeral 5. Reveal the villain's hand, which is Y.
Right, letter Y.
Yeah, letter Y. A, Chris says, I said Y! Even if he always said there's no way he had Y. B, play back the hand of both C and S say, oh yeah, a lot. And Dave finishes by saying, I think you'll find this applies to most hands of the week and could easily be adapted for those rare situations that force you to deviate from the subject at hand.
I tell you, you can tell that David really listens to the show a lot. I love that about him.
Oh boy. I tell you, we have a doozy of a hand of the week this week too. Our hand of the week, I'm not going to spell spoil too much until we get there, but he is on 6 or 7 levels above us, Chris.
Okay.
So if there's ever a hand for us to apply this common sense approach to, it might be today's. And of course, we will not at all.
That was hilarious. Oh, my God. Well, you know, we have been stirring up a lot of reaction from a lot of people about a lot of things that we've been doing. It's not even controversial stuff we've been doing, just the topics and stuff. And this next one is our hotline, 813-448-1120. Comes from Doug in Minneapolis, and he wants to talk a little bit about the Zynga situation.
On Facebook, you know, there's no gambling allowed across the board, so that's not going to happen. Same thing for iOS apps on the Apple iPads. Any gambling is strictly prohibited or gaming of that sort. So both of those would have to be removed. If they wanted to go into the pure gaming aspect of it, they'd have to do an external, like an old, they'd have to feel like an old Full Tilt, where they'd be separated completely, including logins from Facebook. That's just the requirement.
Yeah, very good point. And, you know, I think last week's show we talked about the exploring with partners, what that means for Zynga.
Yeah.
I have to assume that those partners include Facebook and Apple and other places, people they need, and that could potentially be a reason that they've been so skittish about getting into this, if they know that, you know, some of the people that that scratch their back are not going to be happy about it, or worse, not let them do it. So, yeah, they have to have those conversations with a lot of those, but I think there's a way around working with those too that Zynga could do, I would think, but then again, I'm not intimately. Familiar with whatever their agreements are, and maybe Facebook actually, you know, wields the power in that relationship.
Plus, like, Apple, you know, it says Apple doesn't allow gaming, but, you know, third-party, you know, software, if they can come up with it, you know what I mean? I can see that people can jailbreak their phone or whatever they call it now, and other things too. So, yeah, I don't think Apple itself allows gaming in their own apps that are sold in their store, but I think that, you know, I know that there were a few online sites that are in the process of trying to get mobile things going. So it'd be interesting this to see what comes out of that too. Because like I said, third party apps can do whatever they want, and if an online site creates a third party app that you can download and use on your phone, you know.
Well,
who knows?
Yeah, and the other thing too you got to realize too is that there's no reason for Facebook or Apple to not be hard on gaming right now, because it's not technically legal.
Right.
It's not regulated.
That's right.
When that changes, then I think that changes for a lot of people.
Yes.
You know, we're already seeing that with the state governments. All of a sudden, hey, let's start talking about it now. So, yeah, once it's open, I mean, I can't imagine any company, except maybe Chick-fil-A, which closes on Sundays, that would not take a hard look at whether they need to get in this when it's actually regulated. But until then, sure, it's easy to say. Not only is it easy to say, but it's probably proper for them to say, hey, we don't want anything at all that can threaten our business model right now.
Yeah. Was there a story about Facebook in the UK exploring gambling?
You know, I thought I heard that. I can't remember exactly reading it, but yeah, I that does sound familiar.
Yeah, so if that was
certainly
true too.
You know, there's no reason for them not to over there, so.
Yeah.
All right, Doug, we appreciate you calling the hotline. Again, that number is 813-448-1120. And send us an email, and we will send you a download of the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games from element26.net.
Why don't you read the mailbag? Because I feel a little cough coming on. I don't want to hack
in
the middle of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not part of the Roman numerals anywhere there. All right, Everett Clark, he loves write in to us. We haven't heard from him in a while. Not actually, we haven't heard from him in a while. We just haven't had him on the show in a while.
Right.
But this is an oldie but a goodie. You know, I talked about it. You know, the hands of the week are just exploding. We got about a dozen of them backed up now. Lots of hotline calls backed up. Getting kind of low on the mailbag thing, so I have to drop into the oldies but goodies here. So Everett's probably moved on since he wrote this. But still a good letter to talk about.
That's a good lesson, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Since I live and play poker in the St. Louis area, great, great, great town. Love going there. I've been playing about twice a week on a regular basis. I only get to play an hour, or at most 2 hours. Oh, that's really rough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I'm traveling and stuff too, if I know I can only play an hour, I don't.
Yeah.
You know, I just only can get a feel for it. You're only going to get what, at best, 30 hands.
Yeah.
Probably less than that. Probably a lot less than that. It's just more of a tease, I think, you know?
Yeah.
But anyhow, that's all he has to play. That's all he has to play. So he plays at most 2 hours now. He says he plays mostly 3-6 limit or 1-2 no limit. But now, Chris, he wants to move up. He says his biggest concern is the next level and limit jumps all the way to 2040.
Whoa.
He says it's by no means the money that concerns me. Well, that's good.
Whoa.
Which is a contribution to anti-up.
That's nice. Exactly.
So by no means the money that concerns him, but the level of play. I don't want to be at the same type of table as a 3-6 where everybody's limping in and not folding. Is it wise to have such a big jump? And he goes on to say, I wish there were other smaller steps for a limit in this area. No Limit Hold'em has this type of slower step up with 1-2, 1-2, 1-2-5, 2-5, and 5-10.
Yeah. Two things spring to mind, and I just wonder if he hasn't tried it or not, but of course, if he only has an hour to play or whatever, it's probably not going to work, but you know, you can always suggest starting a list for 5-10, you know, or whatever it is that you limit, you're looking to play 4-8, whatever,
yeah.
And seeing if people will jump on that list or not, because to me, there might be a lot of people out there going, well, I'm not playing 3-6 because it's too small, and I'm definitely not playing 2040 because it's too big. And so yeah. They just go play no limit, and then they don't even try. So maybe if you try that. But again, if you know, maybe you try to set up a time where and you talk to the poker room managers and say, hey, let's try to get a Thursday night game going where it's 5-10 and spread the word. And maybe people will come down for it and get a regular game going on Thursday nights or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only other thing I could think of is if you definitely don't want to play 2040 because you think it's too big of a jump, maybe start straddling 3-6 if it's allowed. And try to get a couple of hands in where it's bigger than that, and then maybe other people start straddling too. Then maybe half of your hands are straddled, and you're starting to play, you know, whatever it is, depending on the limit that you're playing. I don't know. That's the only thing I could think of to get to play bigger.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, and I wish I could even get a 3-6 limit game here in Florida.
Yeah.
We can't. So my limit game is completely gone. So I totally hear his complaint here. I mean, I guess about moving up. I guess I would say this, if the money doesn't concern you, which is good to hear, I'm not terribly convinced that the play is going to be that much different. I mean, in a 3-6, yeah, it's this no fold 'em, hold 'em, everybody limps in. But remember, there are just as many bad players with a lot of money as there are poor players that are poor. You know, just because you have money doesn't mean that you all of a sudden are a great poker player. So I wouldn't necessarily be intimidated by the fact that the 2040 is going to be really tough. It's definitely going to be different. I don't think you're going to have 6 or 7 people limping in and chasing that jack-high flush all the way in. That's going to be a little different. But if you're a solid player, I think you'll be all right. It's just a matter of whether you can sustain the bigger financial commitment, which he says he can't. So I wouldn't be worried about that. But I like your ideas. I mean, you need to try to get some of those steps going. It's just unfortunate. No Limit Hold'em is just taking over the world.
Well, what's interesting to me is he says that by no means the money doesn't concern him. So to me, if that were the case, why is he playing 1-2 no limit? Wouldn't he want to play something that's bigger, like 5-10 no limit then, and then get his skill? I mean, it's definitely a better skill at 5-10 overall than there is at 1-2. And if money's no concern, I just don't understand why he'd play 1-2 no limit, unless he's just saying that because he doesn't want us to think that he's afraid of money. Because, I mean, I don't understand why he wouldn't play bigger.
Yeah, I did edit this letter a little bit. He had a couple other questions that I was trying to focus on this big one here.
Okay.
And I don't know if I edited this ad or not. I suspect that he's like me and prefers to play limit.
Okay.
And because, you know, there's only 3-6 there, you're kind of forced to dabble in no limit a little bit. And, you know, even though he's got money, there's no reason necessarily to play a 5-10 no limit if you're not comfortable in it. Okay. As much as, you know.
So it's the game itself, not the limits.
Could be, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
Obviously. I mean, obviously he's looking to make that jump in limit. If he was just concerned about the next level, obviously you play no limit because he's right. There's several different steps there, and you know, you move to the 2-5 when you're comfortable there, and then you move to the 5-10 and forever.
That's a good point. Good point.
Yeah, real rough. And you know, it's rough to get these limit games going too. I mean, you're right. You really do have to get, you know, a group of people in on one night. Really, you know, I haven't talked to a poker room manager ever that doesn't want to spread these games. It's just a matter of if there's not enough people there to do it, you know, can't do it. So,
yeah.
You know, what I tell people when they want to get a game going is rather than just get the list started, start talking up among your friends.
Yeah.
If you can walk in there with 5 or 6 people that have money and are ready, hey, start spreading the cards. They're going to get a game going, and then it shows up on the board. Then all of a sudden, people start playing, and it gets it going. So,
and maybe
really
people,
kind of on the players, I think.
Like he said, too, maybe people are in the same boat as him, and that's why they're playing 1-2 no limit. So when you're sitting at the 1-2 no limit table, ask those people, "Hey, you guys ever play limit?" And then they're like, "Yeah, but I can't play 3-6. It's too boring, and 24 is too big." So you never know what that conversation is going to lead to.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And you know, if you find this is a little tougher to do, I think at the 3-6. But if you find yourself, you know, later at night when there's mostly solid players there, you can also be the guy that says, "Hey, you know, do you guys want to switch it to 4-8 or maybe a 3-6-9 or 3-6-12 or something like that, and get it going." And then maybe people decide they like it, and the next day you come in, they're playing that instead of 3-6.
Yeah.
You know, never know. All right, Everett, we appreciate you sending it in, and you're a recipient of our new, more generous swag policy. So we are going to be happy to send you a t-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Antiup store at antiupstore.com.
Hey, we have a call to floor this week, and we have Jody on board to help answer it. It says, it's from Daniel Banks, comes via email. At a 1-3 no-limit hold'em table in Tunica, Mississippi, a player raises and it folds around to the big blind, who says, "Hey, I only have one card." The four says his hand is dead. They cannot back up the action and to ship the $4 pot to the lone raiser. The big blind is ticked and says, "Screw it, I'll play it out with only the one card I have," and starts to throw in his chips to call. The four stops him and says, "I'm sorry, sir, we can't back up the action and your hand is dead." This all makes some sense to me, but then he makes what is an interesting argument. He says, "How can I walk into your room, sit down, and have you take away my money when I have not even taken any action or done anything wrong?" They repeated their ruling.
Well, first I want to thank Dan, not only for sending us in, but he's sailing with us on our March cruise.
Awesome. Awesome.
So, folks, if you want to come on here, and maybe we'll play one card on the big blind. One rotation for Dan. Going on the cruise. But this is what Jody says. They technically aren't wrong with that ruling. What the player did, quote-unquote, wrong was not paying enough attention, protect his own hand, to notice that he didn't have the two cards required to have a valid hand. But it does sound like the explanation could have been more player-friendly. The player is very fortunate he checked his hand when he did. It's very possible for some players to look at one card, see an ace, and get pretty deep into a pot before noticing the problem. In this situation, I simply would give the $3 back from house fund so we can move the game along and keep players happy.
The other thing, too, is that let's say he did do that and he played it into the flop, and the guy in the hand with him flops a royal flush or flops a high hand.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a bad beat happens or something of that nature, which can't happen, which is one card. But, you know, whatever, and doesn't qualify because the right cards weren't dealt out or whatever. That's the last thing you need. So he's not only just thinking of himself, he's hurting other people as well, and they really do have to stop the hand.
Yeah. This is, I think, where the tough thing is that you have some player responsibilities when you're at the table. And I see so many players that kind of just want to ignore that and just think that, hey, they're paying the dealers, they're paying the rake, so everybody should take care of them. And, you know, you got one card. You gotta notice that.
Let me ask you this. Now, I really don't want to extend the show any longer than I have to because how sick I am today, but does this fall back into the old argument we used to have about destined cards and all that?
Yeah.
If you didn't do a flop yet and there's no, and everyone's got their cards enacted, then what's the difference between giving him that card on top and not, you know, the next card to give him two cards?
Yeah, I would say that's different because there's already action.
Because
the destiny card, you know, you're just giving a player a random card before anybody's acted. But once people start acting, then you're picking up on. I mean, what if you were the under the gun and you looked over and saw the big blind? He didn't look very excited about his hand, so he raised.
Yeah.
And then he gets another card. Now he gets excited because now he has pocket aces instead of, I think that's a slippery slope. I think here, hey, you learn your lesson. You got to pay attention. If you don't have two cards, boom, your hand's dead. Now, I did like what Dan said and what the player said is that, hey, wait a minute. You know, I didn't do anything wrong and you can't take my money. And I immediately thought in my head, you know, if I ran this room, I would clearly explain the situation so people understand why the hand's not valid and it has to be dead. But then I would do as Jody said and just, you know, just give it $3, do over, let's go.
Yeah.
And he said out of house funds too, so you're not taking away from the player that raced, just the player that raced, so you're not upsetting him. But yeah, you just want to move it along. I mean, that's the biggest thing for me is not so much the efficiency of, hey, let's just move it along. But I can see these things falling apart into these four-hour discussions, and that's the last thing I think any player wants.
Yeah.
You know, let's make a fair ruling and move on.
Okay.
All right, Dan. Well, we appreciate you sending it in. We'll see you on the cruise, and you're going to like your swag here because you'll be playing with them on the cruise. Deck of J-Design playing cards, official playing cards of Ante Up. You can pick up your own decks in the Ante Up store at anteupstore.com.
Dr. Frank wrote in this week. It's always nice to have Dr. Frank on the show.
Yeah, this conceding chips thing got a lot of hair up on people's back.
Yeah.
Their necks.
He said that you didn't mention it, but one important reason not to remove tournament chips from play is that it affects the, quote, average stat calculation. He says, I don't use that calculation much, but what do I know? He said some pros like Vanessa Russo use it all the time, and Action Dan Harrington makes mention of it in his tournament books, though he doesn't use it as much as M. It is nice being able to figure out if you are above or below average, so mucking around with the number of chips in play makes that difficult to figure. For a short stacker like you, Scott, it probably makes no difference. You're way below average. End of story.
A little playful jab there. All right, well, I jab back at Frank. I appreciated the sentiment, but a couple things. I mean, one, if you're in any decent tournament, they have a tournament clock, and almost all the tournament clocks now have the average chip calculated for you, right?
That's correct.
So you're never really at a disadvantage of that. But here's really, I think, the bigger weakness is that, again, remember, we're talking about a re-entry tournament. So up until late entry on the second day or the last day of re-entry, that average chip stack's going to fluctuate a lot anyhow.
Mm.
You know, you get 10 more people to sit down, that's another 100,000 chips in play at 10,000 starting. I think really... At that point, those people are figuring it have to know that the chips are going to change a lot until you get past that the final entry part, right?
Well, yeah. The one thing, and it would seem to me that it's nominal because if you're leaving a tournament and surrendering your stack, it would mean that there's not that many chips that you're losing. Yeah. So I mean, when you aggregate them all together or whatever, and then it becomes a decent sized stack. So maybe Frank's right that way. But the one thing that I would want to say to defend this is that, you know, when I talked to Jeff at Foxwoods on my last trip up there, you know, he talked about how they literally could not do re-entry tournaments because the software won't let them, no matter what their workaround was. And I thought to myself, well, I don't know if software will allow you to take chips out of the average chip stack to do the right chip stack for you on the computer anyway. So when you say any decent tournament does the average chip stack for you, but if they're taking chips out of play, I don't know if it will do that.
That's true. Well, yeah, you're right. That's a good point.
So I don't know if it will or not. It probably could, but again, if they can't even figure out how to do re-entry with that software, I would imagine that they're not going to let them take out 500 chips or 8,000 chips.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I don't know for sure whether they could do that. I mean, I guess I would say, as you mentioned, that the amount of chips being taken out of play is very small. It probably doesn't change any calculations, any degree of problem, but again, I don't know that for sure yet either, so that's a good point.
Yeah.
All right, well, Mr. Noswag also wanted to call in and give us his feedback on this, and this is what he had to say.
In the scenario that you were proposing, the one thing that you are forgetting or not realizing is that you're actually putting more chips into play and having basically the same amount of players. Example, you start out with 10,000, and at the end of the night, the guy ends up with 500. And he knows that he's not going to come back the next day for 500, but he wants to rebuy. So he forfeits the 500, and he actually puts 10,000 new chips into play. So you've actually got 9,500 additional chips in play that you wouldn't have had if it wasn't a re-entry.
No. It wasn't that. I don't know. Did we actually not consider that? I mean, we knew that more chips would be in play, but do we really want more chips in play? Do we even care that there are more chips in a tournament?
Yeah.
Why do we care about that?
Yeah.
Do we?
I mean, I guess this call is probably in reference to I was mentioning how, you know, you're taking chips out of play and you should be concerned about it. So I guess if I'm arguing that, then I guess you should be concerned with more chips coming into play. So I'm willing to give him a style point for it.
Okay. I never really thought about when I enter a tournament, I don't say, oh my God, there's going to be 8 million chips in play. Wow, I got to get into that event. Or, you know, I mean, it doesn't make any difference to me. It's the people that matter, not the, and the money that matters, not the chips themselves. So I never even thought about that, really, because I don't think it's a point. But I understand what he's saying. I mean, I know it does mean more chips, but again, that doesn't mean anything to me when I'm playing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my argument of taking out is that if I'm in a tournament, I want those chips to be won by me.
Yeah.
Or someone.
Yeah.
Taking them out. I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that I want more chips added in. That's a whole different argument, I think. But the fact that there are chips that I could win that you're not allowing me to win now is kind of my beef.
Right. I mean, I know what he's saying.
It's a very small beef, too,
right,
to be honest.
I'm sure that when he's saying when you re-enter, there's 10,000 more that you can win now, but that's not really the point, I don't think.
I mean, yeah, it's more overall chips, but it's a different kind of chip.
Yeah, different chips.
Like salt and vinegar versus wavy.
Oh, man. Don't make me laugh. It makes me want to cough.
All right, one last time. We're going to let everybody know about the brand new links that my good partner, Mr. Flemmy, sends put up on our website at aniatmagazine.com. Go to the quick link section on the right-hand side of our homepage, and you can easily be whisked away to our archives of columns from Joe Navarro, Jonathan Little, and, of course, Lee Childs. So you get all their Aniat Magazine columns at one click. So if you're looking for a crash session in strategy, there is a way to do it.
And don't forget our cruise schedule. 2012, massive year for us. You can go to antiupmagazine.com/cruise and see our schedule. But just as a reminder, it's March 17th out of Tampa. You can still buy a cruise for that, too, if you want. August 27th out of Port Canaveral and November 10th out of Baltimore. And don't forget, hey, you know, they should be liking us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, right?
Of course, of course. I mean, well, more so on Facebook than Twitter.
No, definitely on Twitter. We got a little rivalry going here now. I'm trying to get as many people as possible on Twitter. Don't go to Facebook. Go to Twitter.
Yeah, I think the level of attachment on Twitter is much less. I think people just like, oh, click, like, follow. I don't think they're really as engaged as much as Facebook, so... At least that's the way I'm going to spin it when the Twitter actually surpasses.
Well, if that's the case, it's so easy to just do it. Then, hey, go ahead quickly. Just go ahead and just follow us real quickly on Twitter.
And one last moment on the cruise, too. Please go to the page at aniatmagazine.com/cruise. Lots of free cruises up for grabs in March. In February. Lots of rooms here in Florida. And then, of course, Suncoast out in Vegas is given away for the Port Canaveral. So win your way on board.
Okay, we have a packed Antiup news desk this week.
Yeah, again, another all full tilt all the time news desk.
Remarkable. This site hasn't been running in ages, and yet it just keeps filling up our news desk.
Yeah. All right, a U.S. District Court has dismissed civil RICO claims against 10 Full Tilt executives and 2 of 5 Full Tilt units sued by players who were owed money by the online poker site. The judge said it couldn't be ascertained whether the direct cause of plaintiffs' injuries was actions by the company or from the government's Black Friday shutdown.
Okay. Do we need to comment on that, or we just move on?
In the whole Black Friday discussion we had, this is the one thing I mentioned, when people were like ready to string up the Full Tilt executives, and again, not defending them, but yeah, if Black Friday never happened, would they have been able to get out of that jam?
Yeah.
And we all never know, obviously, because Black Friday happened, and I think that's what the judge is saying is, you know, hey, maybe there was some stuff going on at Full Tilt, but, you know, was it the government that was to blame for this collapse, or was it for the company? And I can't tell, so I can't move forward with this.
Okay. Well, Gaming Intelligence reports Full Tilt owners have agreed to final terms for forfeiting the company to the Department of Justice, who will proceed with paying back U.S. players owed money, while new owner Group Bernard Tapie works to get the site's licenses renewed so it can pay back the non-U.S. players.
Yeah, very quiet on this, and again, just rumors and stuff. We hate to suggest that too much, but it does seem like things are moving forward, and we'll see what happens. And Carblatter reports that Chris Ferguson's lawyer says his client is expected to have his case with the Department of Justice settled within the first half of the year. Said a lot of other things, but nothing really important. But it sounds like a lot of things are moving. So hopefully here within 6 months or so, we'll never have to mention Full Tilt again until they advertise.
Hey, we get to finish an O'Malley's move this week. Very exciting stuff. Let's listen to part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley.
This week, we're sitting at that same old 1-2 No Limit Hold'em casino cash game. We're at a full table of 10 players. The action's been pretty wild post-flop, but there's been a lot of limping pre-flop, with raises coming from ace-queen or better. We currently sit with 325 and are the big stack at the table, but only by about 25 bucks. The max buy-in here is 300. The blinds post, the under-the-gun limps in, under-the-gun plus 1, 2, and 3 all fold, and the under-the-gun plus 4 and 5 call. We look down in the cutoff at 8 of hearts, 6 of hearts. Pretty good hand with so much limping going on. We make the call, as does the button, and the small blind, and the big blind checks. An interesting 7-handed pot, which is now $14. We're met with mixed emotions as we see the flop come down, queen of hearts, 9 of hearts, 4 of hearts. This would be an awesome flop if we were 2- or 3-handed. So we set out to make a plan for this hand. If it's checked to us, we're going to bet about pot or more to disguise our hand and thin the field. If someone bets to us, we'll reevaluate. The small blind checks, as does the big blind and the under the gun, but the under the gun plus 4 leads out for $9, and the under the gun plus 5 more than triples that bet to $30. These two players have been extremely wild all night, and since they just limped preflop, there's no putting them on a hand. They play fearlessly and aggressively, and their chip stacks show that. Constantly going up and down, like a roller coaster. The player directly to my right has roughly 270 after his raise. We're in a tight spot because the player behind us has about 100 and has been a rock all night. We try to gauge what he's going to do, but he calmly sits, shuffling his chips, patiently waiting for us to make our decision. Normally, we would love to have two maniacs on our right. But in a situation like this, it's hard to tell if our baby flush is good or second best. It's that classic way ahead or way behind scenario. Not to mention the three players that checked to the under the gun plus 4. We have no idea what they're going to do, although we suspect they'll get out of the way. After the rake, the pot is at $48, and we have to call 30 to see the turn. So we've come to a decision. Call? Fold? Or is there a case for raising?
Good gravy!
Good gravy.
What a spot to be in here. Normally I'd have no fear that someone else flopped a flush. I mean, it's such a long shot that even we flopped a flush.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't really worry about it as much as people usually do, right?
Right.
But we have 7 players in this hand. What was this, Everett Clark's 3-6 game in St. Louis here? I think it's hard to ignore that possibility. I'm not saying you should be worried about it, but you got to at least consider it. Now we got to factor in that our two bettors are aggressive, so we never know exactly what they're doing. And I think we find ourselves in a real pickle here. I'd like to believe that both of those guys are trying to play off the fears of everyone else. I mean, it works. I mean, you're at a table and 3 diamonds come and someone bets and everybody whoosh, folds like a cheap rug, right?
Yeah.
And hopefully the re-raiser here has something like a naked ace of hearts. So, I mean, so I think we're ahead. But if we're wrong, we're probably almost always drawing dead now. But, you know, I'm just not going to be scared here. I'm going to raise to 80 bucks, reassess from there if I get any callers, and see what happens.
Well, when I play a hand like this, there's two trains of thought, for me at least. We play it to hit a flush, or we play it to hit, a straight or a two pair or something. Straight or two pair are inferior made hands, obviously, but to me it's better in this situation because of the size of our flush. It's so small.
Sure.
If we didn't want to be in this situation, then we should have folded preflop or raised preflop to thin the field. In this case, I really don't think the bettors or raisers have us beat. If I raise, then the guy behind us is of no consequence because of the stack he has. Right. And if I believe I am ahead, then I will shove on a non-heart turn. So I just really feel like we've got the best hand right now, and we need to protect it somehow. And if nothing gets there on the turn, go with our read and probably shove.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I was going to raise to 80. I think that's probably standard, if not more. And you're right. If you make that raise, whether this guy has 100 behind us,
right,
it's no big deal. I mean, if he's going to call, he's going to call. If he's got a, he's got an ace high flush right now, he's got his beat regardless. He's not going anywhere because we raise. Right. You know, so I'm not worried about him at all. I'm with you on that.
Okay, let's listen to part two.
Hello again. We're probably ahead here, but with so many opponents in the hand, the right move is the toughest one. Laying down our baby flush. It takes us quite a while to do so, but we get instant gratification when the solid player behind us puts his $100 into the pot. Everyone else folds back around to the under the gun plus four who calls, followed by the 270 stack pushing in his remaining chips. He's got the end of the gun plus four covered, and he quickly makes the call. The main pot is around 350, and the side is nearing 250. We watch as the under the gun plus four turns over queen of spades, 10 of diamonds. We had him dominated. The under the gun plus five shows queen of diamonds, 10 of hearts. We were about 70-30 to beat him. And finally, the button shows ace of hearts, 9 of diamonds. Roughly another 70-30. When we figure in all of our opponent's hands, we're about a 70% favorite to take this pot down. The turn and river bring the queen of clubs, 7 of clubs, and we would have scooped a huge pot. Perhaps we should have raised preflop to thin the field and disguise our hand. But that's the point that's up for discussion. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley, and I hope to see you on the felt.
J-Wow.
J-Wow.
Wow. Just wow. That's all I gotta say. I guess I'm gonna go back to what you said. I'm not really sure why we're playing this hand if we're gonna fold when we flop a flush.
Right.
You know I called it a pickle, but I don't think I ever gave any serious thought to folding here. What I was trying to figure out is, you know, whether I should, you know, just call and hope that my hand holds up, or whether I should just be active here and get it in and hope it holds up. I mean, regardless of, I think you got to hope your hand holds up here. With all this action, somebody has something out there, right?
Yeah.
And more likely, it was what the small blind had, you know, the ace out there, and you got to fade a couple cards on that. So I think that's the situation you get in when you play the 8-6. But if you're going to fold it, you're right. And back to what you said, too, I'm not going to play this for two pair or trips. So at that point, then really, what are you playing this for? A straight?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't seem worth it to me.
My first thought was bow, wow, wow. This is pretty remarkable. I mean, the action after the fold is what's remarkable. To think that all these people got it in, you know,
yeah,
with those hands. I mean, yeah, I can. It's pretty remarkable. You know, if all that had happened before it got to us, I would have folded. If it went shove, you know, yeah, then I would have said, okay, somebody's got to have me beat here. But because it didn't happen that way, I just never entertained folding there, and I would have stayed until the end the way it unfolded. So I can't imagine letting go of that flush. Why did I play the hand if I didn't want to hit a flush with it?
Yeah.
Brutal.
All right. Wow. J-Wow.
J-Wow.
Hey, this is Hoyt Corkins, and I'm listening to Annie Up.
All right, the most anticipated announcement each year, aside from the frozen orange juice concentrate crop report.
Feeling good, Billy Ray?
Looking good? It's the schedule for the World Series of Poker. And that happened just in time to suck the spotlight away from Punxsutawney Phil this year.
That was on yesterday. I watched it.
Oh, was it? It's probably going to be on the whole weekend.
Yeah, I love that movie.
But, you know, they dragged the rat out of the hole this morning, and the day before the World Series announces the schedule. Steal the spotlight. With 61 bracelets up for grab, the world's biggest tournament series will play out in Las Vegas May 27th through July 16th this year. Lots more details, no doubt, will be released in the coming months. But for now, there's plenty for us to talk about and to make the schedule worthy of our main topic this week.
61 bracelets, Scott.
Yeah.
That's one or two a day for a month straight if you did it that way. I mean, that's just crazy. I mean, when you think about the World Series started, there were like 9 guys in the first World Series main event. Now there's 61 bracelets. I mean, that's crazy. It's almost 7 times the amount of players that were even in the first World Series.
Right, yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah.
You know, and I talked a little bit about this bracelet inflation on Short Stack Radio this week, you know, because I guess one of their guests before me was a little dismayed that this $1 million tournament, which we'll talk more about later on, is a bracelet event. I missed it if it is. I didn't think it was, but they said it was. But regardless, it doesn't really matter to the point of the conversation. And I think the argument was, you know, hey, it's a $1 million tournament. Why should that be a bracelet event? I mean, here's the thing. They're giving out 61 bracelets this year.
I know.
That's 3 more than last year. So they gave out 58 last year. They've been giving out 50 for the last couple years, right?
Yeah, over 50. Yeah, over 50, yeah.
At this point, if you don't know someone personally that has a bracelet, I think you need to leave the house because there's a lot of bracelets out there. So I'm not saying the bracelet doesn't mean anything. And trust me, I would love to have one of my own that I won. But I don't think we need to get selective on the bracelets anymore. If it's an open event, you can give a bracelet out now, I think.
Yeah, it's incredible. 61. Yeah. I mean, how many bracelets are out there now? Think about it in history. You know what I mean? You're getting way up there. And it's like, I don't know if maybe it does water it down a little bit. It doesn't make it any more easy to win or less difficult, but I'm just saying 61 chances at a bracelet this year. Obviously, some overlap and everything, but that's a lot of friggin' bracelets. And then you add in the Europe ones. You know, you're looking at like 70 bracelets for a calendar year or so. That's just crazy.
Yeah, yeah. No, I certainly don't buy into the water down. I think it's great to recognize someone for their accomplishments. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if you're looking for something that's more an exclusive company, there's other ways of doing that. You know, you only have so many main event winners. You only have so many of the $50,000 player championship winners. I mean, that's where the exclusivity is now. I mean, now let's just reward people that come out and play. I mean, that's why we want to play. That's why there's so many of these weekend warrior events that we'll talk about later. It encourages average Joes like us to go out there and win something that we can brag about.
So. Well, here's the other question I have for you then. What constitutes being a bracelet event? Why do they sit down and say, that one's only a $500 buy-in, it's not worthy of a bracelet, but $1,000 is? And why is $1,000 worth a bracelet and a $50,000 one still just worth a bracelet? You know, I mean, yeah, it's got diamonds in it or whatever, and they get a trophy too or whatever, and there's more money.
Yeah, it's the trophy, man. It's totally about the trophy.
But really, I mean, what's the criteria that they use to say, this one's a bracelet, this one isn't, or...
Well, I think they've always done, it has to be an open event first, so you know, seniors events and ladies events, it's not fair to give a bracelet out to an event that not everybody can enter. Same with the casino employees. This year, they've added a couple exhibition tournaments, which we'll talk about later. And, you know, those are probably debatable whether those should have been bracelet events. But other than that, I mean, they're giving bracelets out for everything else. So
that's why I think the $1 million one is like, is that are you sure it's a non-bracelet? I haven't really looked into it.
No, I mean, you're going to make me search my my email here to confirm.
No, that's all right. Just, you know.
No, now I want to know because my nose is...
Because that's open, right? That is. If you got $1 million, you can...
Yeah, if you got $1 million, you sit down and play, you know?
Well, Bill Gates is going to have a $1 trillion event, and he's going to play in it by himself, and he's going to win a bracelet that way. You know, if you can afford it, you know, you're going to win a bracelet somehow.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I guess the argument on that was, you know, it's an open event, so, I mean, it doesn't mean that you have to have $1 million. You just have to have a, you know, a backer.
Yeah, it's true. A backer.
That can get you in.
Or, you know, have $100,000 lying around and find 9 other guys who want to play in a $100,000 event with you and win a satellite.
And I did confirm it is, in fact, a bracelet event.
So it is a bracelet event.
Correct.
Yes. I thought it was because I remember them saying that. That's when I first heard it, I got kind of upset, saying, oh, so if you have $1 million, you know that you're going to have a 1 in 20 chance or whatever it is to win a bracelet now, which is so weird.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, but, again, I mean, there's different degrees. I mean, remember, in the non-poker community, which most of us reside in most of our lives, you know, I think your friends are just as impressed as anything if you have a bracelet, right?
Yeah.
In the World Series. No one's going to ask you, oh, hey, you won that in Raz with 12 people. But in the poker community, obviously, different bracelets have different, I would think, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there still is that weight given by who you're talking to that counts, I think.
Yeah, I guess so. It's just hilarious that, you know, you have enough money, you can buy the White House and you could buy a bracelet.
Well, you still got to win.
You still have to win. That's right. You still have to win.
Trust me, there's a lot of non-slouches already entered in this tournament, so you're going to have to play some pretty good poker.
Yeah, and I was looking at some of the names, and I'm like, wow, where'd they get that money? It's got to be backers, man. It's got to be backers. All right, let's move on. More tables this year, which will, as you'll see later on, will affect a lot of things. 470, which is 92 more tables. Where do they keep them all?
Yeah. Well, it's going in the Brasilia room this year, which, you know, I think back when we started going, used to be the Expo.
The
Expo's long gone, and then they've added more tables there and more tables. I don't know where they're going to put more, but every year they seem to add more, so we'll see where it goes from here. But anyway, that's what I was thinking about, 470. And think about it, the Commerce has, what, about 180 tables? And quite a few of those are not traditional poker tables. You know, the California Games tables. But that's, it's what, more than 2.5 times the size of that?
Yeah, that's crazy.
And then think about your average local poker room. I mean, here in Florida, we're a little blessed because the poker rooms here are a little bit larger than normal. But most places I go, they're probably 10 tables, 15 tables.
Yeah.
At 10 tables, that's 47 poker rooms in one building. How crazy wild is that?
Yeah. It's so funny because when you look at when you're driving by the Rio, you don't think that it's very big, that it could even possibly host tables. And not only can it host that many tables, but it's got like millions and millions of more square feet left too on top of it. It's hilarious how much room is in that place.
Yeah, they're definitely running out of room in the conference center area where they have it now. I mean, I think they're squeezing every little bit. I mean, I'm excited. A little anxious to see where the media room is this year.
Yeah, really.
We walk in there, and there's two tables set up there, and people are playing. but yeah, they're squeezing every space they can out of it. 470 tables, so wow.
Well, they got more Weekend Warrior events, as you were alluding to earlier. Every Saturday in June is a $1,500 No Limit Hold'em event, and every Sunday in June is a $1,000 No Limit Hold'em event. Opening bracelet event is a 1,000 no limit event on Memorial Day weekend. July 4th and the 5th is the last bracelet event before the main event, and it's a $1,000 two starting days event. So a lot of affordable events for you guys to get out there and try to take home the gold.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, it's easy to criticize Caesars for the running of the World Series because it's the biggest thing, and you already know it's impossible to make any poker player happy, let alone millions of them. And they're just an easy target. But I definitely want to say here, I give them a lot of credit for really putting a lot of thought into the schedule and what they do and trying to make as many people as happy as possible. And I think this is important. I mean, and, you know, people keep saying, oh, the economy. I don't think the economy is as bad as it has been the last couple of years. But, you know, this is an homage to players everywhere. I mean, I'm not saying everybody can afford a $1,000 tournament, but a lot of people can afford a satellite for a $1,000 tournament.
Yeah.
And the fact that they have so many of these on the schedule gives us average Joes a shot at getting one of those bracelets for whatever it's worth.
It's just amazing. You know, you take all of that into consideration and then think about all the other series that are going on between the Venetian and the Grand and Binion's. I mean, oh my God, they're in Caesars. There are so many tournaments going on during the World Series. God, there's just so much money out there. It's remarkable. At what point are we going to hit, you know, maximum density and you know, what? Oh my God, it's just critical mass. Crazy.
Well, the other thing too is that I really do think Caesars Entertainment is masterful in marketing, not necessarily in the traditional sense, much to our chagrin.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. If you got rid of all these $1,000 events, which I think they did for a couple years, I mean, I think it was $1,500 was the lowest one, and they didn't have a lot of those. Think about the number of people that you cut out of this that are not going to get on a plane and go out to World Series and try to, you know, take a shot at glory. While you run a bunch of $5,000, $10,000 events for the pros. Having a $1,000 event, you've got literally thousands of people now that opens it up to that are at home saying, hey, I'm going out to the World Series this weekend, building excitement for it among people that might not otherwise get excited about it.
Yeah.
You know, if, again, my neighbor probably doesn't know a thing about poker, but if I'm talking to, hey, I'm going to play the World Series, hey, good luck, have fun. And then they might, you know, stop and watch it on TV when it's on just because it mentioned it. Whereas if it was a $5,000 event, nope, not going. Not telling my neighbor and not getting that press. So I think it's kind of genius on their part. And very benevolent, too, at the same point.
You know, and at first, too, when I first saw how many $1,000 events there were, you wonder, you know, oh my God, do the other casinos kind of cringe when they see that, thinking, oh, they're going to take away some of our business. But at the same time, no, I think they're going to attract more players out there who would be willing to enter your $500 deep stacks or your $300 Binions events, you know. So I think it's actually a good thing that they have those, and I think the other casinos will reap the benefits as well. Not, I don't think it'll hurt them at all.
No, of course not. And of course, we mentioned the most expensive tournament ever. It's been in the works since last World Series, the $1 million buy-in bracelet event. And part of that money is going to benefit charitable causes as well, too. It's going to be very interesting to watch this, I think.
And one of the things that is pretty interesting, too, is I know that, I guess that Guy Gobert Terry guy was probably behind this, because it was this one drop thing, I think, was the start of it.
Right, yep.
But it's just remarkable to me, some of the people that entered it. I mean, I think Duhamel is in it, right? He got some of his money back just recently, too, which I'm sure we'll talk about maybe in an upcoming show. But then the other thing, too, the way they're changing this World Series a little bit, really, there's the main thing, the main event. To me, it's remarkable how much the main event has changed now, and we'll get into that a little bit. It's going to run from the July 7th to the 16th and only have 3 day ones, and that's because of the more tables, right? They have more tables that can fit a real winner.
Yeah, absolutely.
And no days off now. And then 5 full levels of play each day. Players playing day 1C now can literally reach the final table in as little as 8 days. Yeah. And because of the presidential election, final table finishes October 28th to the 30th. So, what do we call it now?
Yeah. I was going to call it the October 8 plus 1.
Well, you know, we could have him just play down to 8 instead of 9 and then call it.
I thought about that. Yeah.
You know,
or and then, we could call it the November, not November 9.
The not November. Right. Not the, not ready, November 9. The not ready for November 9. Final 9. But, you know, like 8 October obviously means 8. So, you know, you use the Italian Otto, October Otto. So, I mean, I don't know. It's pretty funny. What are they going to say? Are they going to just call it the October 9? That's it? Just call it the October 9?
Well, I think it should air on ESPN Ocho.
The Ocho.
Dodgeball.
That was a great one.
But no, I'm curious how people are going to react to the compressed schedule. You know, for me, again, I talk about this to people a lot. You know, for us, when we play a tournament, if it goes 5 or 6 hours, we start to get a little cranky.
Yeah.
You know, because we just don't play tournaments that long. You know, you're talking, even at this, you're talking in 8 days, 10 hours of play every day, of actual play, not counting the breaks. That's 80 hours.
Yeah.
The quickest path there. That's 2 full work weeks of time at the table. In a game where one mistake can cost you everything, that is a lot of stress.
Yeah, and in 8 days. It's in 8 days.
Yeah.
That's just crazy.
So I wonder how many people would rather just get in and get it done. I think I might be that way. Versus the people that are going to miss these off days where they can just take the day off, recompress, go to the spa, go to the pool, nightclub or something, and get their mind off of it and recharge and come back strong the next day.
Man, I don't know. That's crazy. They'll have the Beatles 8 days a week music playing over the intercom all week long. I mean, that is remarkable. I mean, a lot of people say, well, you know, it's for one time only, and, you know, just, if you won $8 million, it'd be worth it for 2 weeks of work or whatever. But, yeah, but, wow. I mean, that is some serious mental strain on you to be at the top of your game with the world's best, essentially, with the world's best for 80 hours straight. That's crazy.
And of course, we talked about the final table being played in October rather than November. But there were some whispers that they might not do this at all this year. They might just go back to finishing it up there or having a month break or something like that. So what do you think about it being essentially unchanged?
I think they found money is what I think. I think the reason why they were doing it before was to get money. And when they didn't have money behind it, they didn't do that, but now that they may have found somebody to, you know, sponsor, or that they weren't sure they were going to get or whatever. But yeah, some of the rumblings were that they were losing sponsors and then whatever, and then the live play was so exciting that, you know, they would rather do it all live and just go straight through with it. But I think that they found either somebody demanded it or they found the money or something. But
just heard bad rumors.
Or we just heard terrible rumors. That's true. But I don't really care either way. You know, it makes some difference to me because, you know, we're not going out there for it unless we absolutely have to. So
right.
Whether it ends or not, it's not that big of a deal because you're watching it each week live. Anyway, so I don't know. I don't think it really matters anymore. I think that the newness of it has worn off, and I think the hype of it. You know what's funny is I don't like to put you on the spot with this. Well, that's not true. I like to put you on the spot.
You're allowed to.
But remember when we were talking about, oh, this is going to make them famous, and this is going to make them, you know, by doing this, they'll have 3 months, and now they're going to become household names. And well, I mean, really, try to rattle off the original November 9 for me right now. You can't. Try and rattle off the second November 9. You know what I mean? It's hard to even remember who won the damn second November 9. Never mind, you know what I mean? So to make them household names, there's no way. So, I mean, really, what's it accomplishing other than just building up more money for them?
Well, yeah, but again, we've talked about this. I mean, this goes back to what's your definition of famous, too.
Right.
And, you know, the household name really isn't nationwide or worldwide. It's locally.
Yeah.
And if you're building up, you know, a lot of media support and people getting to know somebody like a Dennis Phillips in St. Louis that may not know him, then, or Darvin Moon in, you know, West Virginia or Maryland, then that's the benefit of it. So, I mean, they're not household names everywhere, but they're household names somewhere.
Yeah.
Whereas they probably wouldn't be if you just finished it off. But yeah, small consideration now. But what I'm most excited about is the new events. And they have, say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 new events this year. A couple of them are exhibition only, not bracelet events. So they're just on there for fun. But very, very progressive, I think, on their part. I mean, you look at, I always look to California for some of these newer type tournaments, you know, because you got so many tournaments out there that you got to break away from the pack and do some carnival or novelty tournaments, I like to call them. But it's a big step, I think, for someone at the World Series to get into that game and do some of this stuff. And I wonder how much of it is desire on players' parts for it and how much of it is just trying to mix it up.
Yeah, I think it probably is a combination. I think they're trying to create buzz, trying to roll with it. I mean, you know, the trends and stuff like that, we didn't talk about the events are yet, but let's just take an example. One of them is a four-handed no-limit hold'em event.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that is taken into consideration that the online poker thing is gone, and these guys are looking for lots of action, lots of hands per hour. So they're saying, hey, we know there's going to be a ton of online guys there. Let's try to make them happy and put an event in that lets them play a ton of hands and be an action junkie, because a lot of these guys do that. So I think that is. I think it's progressive, and I my hat's off to them. I think it's very good. And even now, let's just talk about them now. The first one's the opening weekend is going to have a re-entry. Mm-hmm. The big question is whether or not you can surrender your stack. No, I'm kidding. but it's a $1,500 event and allows them to enter on 1 or 2 days, and players who are eliminated on day 1A can re-enter on day 1B. So
This re-entry thing is kind of the new hot thing, I think.
Yeah.
Obviously, we talk about it on the show a lot, too. So to me, that's not a surprise that that's been introduced. And I like the fact that they did it on the first event. I think that's the Memorial Day one, too. I could be wrong. Again, it's appealing to those people that don't have a lot of money to play but are going to fly out on their weekend and take a shot. And now, you know, you take that $1,500 shot, you have a bad first day, you can take another shot the next day and essentially play one tournament twice and, you know, go back home.
Yeah, yeah.
Heads up, No Limit Hold'em PLO Mix, $3,000 bracelet event, capped at 512 entrants. So good seats still available. Registered early. I haven't played a lot of PLO Heads Up, so I'm interested on that. I mean, gosh, what do you fold when you play Heads Up PLO?
Yeah, I don't think you do. I think you fold when you were stealing, and then he re-raises you. I think maybe then you might consider folding, but other than that, wow, you're pretty much playing every hand there. Heads Up PLO.
Yeah, I give him credit for Heads Up too. I mean, most of us would love to play Heads Up tournaments. They're just such a waste of resources.
It's hard.
For poker rooms everywhere. I mean, obviously they've got 470 some tables now, so they could probably spare some here. But they introduce yet another heads up event. I think says something. But it's this next event that I'm most excited about. It's called a min-max event, and I guess they played this at the World Series of Poker Europe last year. The Grinder won it. I noticed it's on a schedule for this Aruba tournament that's coming up at the end of April as well, too. And it's a $5,000 event, but here's how it works. Day one, you're playing nine-handed. If you survive the day two, now you play six-handed. And then if you survive that, the rest of the tournament is played heads-up.
Wow.
So you've got to be able to play the full ring version well. You got to be able to play shorthanded well. And then you got to have a really good heads-up game.
I think they should rename it the Max Min event. Because it aggressively gets smaller as you go along. That's pretty incredible.
That's true.
Now, I wonder how they determine, like, you know, if you have, I guess, one person gets a bye, the chip leader gets a bye, if it's an odd amount of people for heads-up play until... That's kind of weird.
Yeah, it may play down to a certain level before they go to heads-up.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a day one, day two. It may play a while on day three.
If I go hand-to-hand, right? Maybe they go hand-to-hand until they get to their 64 or whatever it is, and then...
Could be, yeah.
That's pretty wild.
I'm sure it's on the structure sheet, so we can answer that pretty easily. But one of the things that... the guys at Schwarzack Radio mentioned to me that what happened out in Europe is, you know, it's a blind draw for those heads-up brackets.
Right.
And all the chip leaders ended up in one side of the bracket.
Oh, man.
So you can imagine that. You're waiting through. There's a lot more money on that side of the bracket than on your side of the bracket. So you end up, you know, heads-up. You could have a 10, 15, 20, one the chip advantage over somebody else for really no fault of that person other than they just got a bad draw.
That's brutal. You're the short stack and your head's up against some guy who literally has 14 times your stack or something, and you have to play him heads up. Oh, man.
Well, think about it. The two chip leaders ended up getting in the first round.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
What a slugfest that would be, you know?
Wow. Well, that's a crazy event.
But overall, I really like this because here's the thing. I mean, anybody who listens to the show knows that we love to call it crappy Nolan and Hold'em, and I think it's a little bit boring. But this is the game that people want to play. So I understand that. So I give them credit for trying to do something where you have to interject a little bit more skill involved. And I'm certainly not saying there's no skill, no limit. There's tons of skill. So don't go crazy on the forum about that. It's nice to see that they're finding a way to really kind of break the really good players out of the crowd in a tournament that does have a good portion of luck involved. I mean, you enter that $1,000 weekend warrior events. You got, 2,000 people in that thing, right?
Yeah, probably.
You know, I don't care how good a player you are, you know, you got to have some luck along the way. This is trying to mitigate the luck a little bit and really force you to find out how good you are at a couple of different disciplines of the same game.
Man, that's crazy. Well, we mentioned the four-handed No Limit Hold'em a little while ago. It's a $2,500 event, and it's always you're always going to be four-handed. And it's pretty cool because, you know, it's going to be under the gun plus one. Than the button. I mean, it's just crazy if you think about it that way. So half the table is in a blind, forced money put in the pot, dead money. So that's going to be some serious raising, re-raising, three betting, four betting crap going on there.
I would actually love to play this. I mean, I kind of like the min-max format, but I think if I had somebody just gave me money and said, "Hey, play any of these new events," I might play the heads up. But I like the four-handed one. I really do. I think that's an interesting format. I know they started doing some of those online before Black Friday happened. But it is. It's kind of like heads up with a little bit more flavor to it.
It's weird that you say that, too. I would think that you would shy from that just because you're sort of tight and don't like loose action junky players at your table.
Well, it's because I don't like it because of so many players at the table. You get into so much trouble. And in a four-handed, you're forced to.
Mm.
So it's almost like that get-out-of-jail-free card.
Yeah, you force it to. You have to do it, so you might as well do it.
Yeah, yeah. So then I don't have to worry about, am I playing too loose? And the four-handed, I have to play loose.
Yeah.
So I don't think I can ever worry about playing too loose at that point. And I'm not trying to... That makes it sound like it's all luck, which it's not. But, I mean, it's... when I'm thinking about whether I should raise under the gun with my pocket fours, I tend to throw them in the muck. Where four-handed, I would never do that.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, I'd probably three or four bet with those at that point, four-handed. You know, it just emboldens you a little bit. I mean, I guess that's why I like the Omaha 8. It's because if I got a good low and high hand, it emboldens me to do what I should have done anyhow.
Yeah.
If I didn't have that, you know.
Yep.
Again, it's going back to that whole alcohol thing. Get a couple of drinks in me, and I'm perfectly normal. Otherwise, I'm a scared rabbit. All right, this next one, we're going to have to get our marketing team on whether we can attach our name to it.
Yeah.
The Ante-Only Tournament.
Yeah.
I mistakenly called it the Annie Up tournament last night on Short Stack. Accidentally, of course. It's an Annie Up tournament, and it's exactly what it is. It's a $1,500 bracelet event. Actually, no, it's not a bracelet event, I don't think. No, this is not a bracelet event. $1,500 event, no blinds, everyone antes, and the action starts to the left of the button. And yep. then the antes keep going up. Obviously, we had the Annie Up only tournaments on PokerStars that did the same thing. Now, when you come in, you got to call the size of the pot, so there's no minimum bet. You know, so if there's 100,000 in the pot, that's what you got to call if you're going to call.
That's just so crazy.
You know, I played a couple of those on Stars before Black Friday. Oh, I miss you so much. And they were kind of fun. I mean, again, it's a different kind of strategy, obviously. But you do get big pots quickly there. You don't have to worry about building it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, the blinds take care of it for you.
The doubles event.
Yeah.
That looks very interesting. It's a non-bracelet event, and it's $560. Now, does that mean the team only has to pay $560?
I knew my cheap partner was going to say that. I do not believe so. I think each of us has to buck up
$500. Oh, man. We start centering our trip around that one, I think. But, yeah, it has teams of two alternating play after each level. So, a very interesting event. I think a lot of people will play it. I think it's going to be a big...
Yeah, I think there's... already a bunch of buzz about that.
Yeah.
Whether too many people are going to try to play this. And it's a one-day event, too. I didn't look at the structure sheet, but obviously I imagine it's much faster than a bracelet event. So it may not be – that might discourage some people. But I got to think. I mean, we were talking about this weekend while you were bringing your buddies out to play. I mean, who wouldn't want to – you know, $560. I mean, it sounds cheap just because of the – you know, you got $1 million event on the schedule.
Yeah, exactly.
$560, that's a tip, you know. It's still a good chunk of change for most players, but you know, you put it together and have a little fun. I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, we did this, we called it a tag team on one of our cruises, right?
Yep.
And I think we had a little more fun with that too. We actually let people like split their cash game stacks too if they wanted to. So when you're one playing, you can go play the cash game. But I'm sure that's not going to happen here. So I guess what I'm wondering is, can you imagine the madhouse and this pressure cooker you're in playing this?
Yes.
Where's your partner going to go on a break? I mean, he's going to go take a whiz, right? You might get a Red Bull or something. But he's going to come back, and he's going to watch you play.
Yeah, he's going to sweat you.
Yeah, and he's going to be watching everybody else. So there's going to be a lot of looky-loos crowded around the tables in this. It's going to be a little crowd control problem there.
Yeah. And you could also be scouting the other players and then telling your partner when he comes back, right, hey, the player in C5 has got a tell or whatever. So there's some strategy involved. And you know, it's like when you're not in a hand, watch what's going on. Well, same thing here. When you're not at the table, watch what's going on. You can help out one way or another. So very interesting thing. And I think that's going to be the dark horse. That's going to have a ton of entrance in it.
Yeah, yeah. I think they're going to really reconsider next year whether they should do it or whether they should make the bracelet event and make it bigger. It's first year to see how it is. So
they're only going to give away one bracelet, though. That'd be hilarious. You guys got to share the bracelet.
You got to wear it on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And
oh, man, that's pretty funny.
Major holidays, and the other one gets it on the other days. That's great. You see that? It goes to court, but you know it's going to go to court.
Yep. Yep. He didn't give it to me on the weekend. I had a girl coming over. I wanted to show her.
Judge Wapner. and then finally, this is a non-bracelet event. I think the Anti-Up is actually, I got confused. There's two exhibitions. Bracelet Bounty event, it's a $1,000 buy-in, non-bracelet event. But if you enter and you have won one of these seven gajillion bracelets that have been given out over the years, you will have a bounty put on your head.
Now, why
would you regard
any this? Bracelet winner enter this event, then?
I knew you were going with this. I have no idea other than, wow, I don't know. I mean... You got to think, you got, what we said, 61 events already. It's impossible for anybody to play all those, I think, unless because they overlap. Though I guess somebody could try. I imagine the most voracious players would probably hit 55 events. Why would you want to enter a $1,000 event that's full of a bunch of knuckleheads where you can't win a bracelet?
And they're gunning for you.
And they're gunning for you.
I mean, there is, you know, there is some,
right?
Yeah, but there is some validity to entering them knowing that they're going to come after you because, you know, you're going to get a lot of bad hands coming after you and you can accumulate a lot of chips.
Yeah.
Just this, how many times, what outweighs what? I would think that you don't want a field of 1,000 people coming after you because you have a bracelet. Imagine if you're the only one in the whole field, too. Oh, man. I would never spend that $1,000 on that. I would spend it on an actual bracelet event anyway.
But, I mean, you're right. A couple things. I mean, one, obviously, if you can adjust your play and know people are gunning for you, which I think people who play a lot of bounty tournaments probably have, and you play a different style, you could probably chip up pretty good. But then, two, I think you're right. I mean, all the people that are who's going to enter this, if you look around and you see a bracelet on somebody's wrist, you know they've got some confidence problems, I think.
Yeah.
They're there to show off.
Yeah.
Phil Homies has got to be playing this run, right? Even though he can't win a bracelet, and he's going to be there because, you know, hey, I'm a bracelet winner and you're not.
Just a crazy, crazy event to end it on. That's just crazy.
Like you said, obviously, a lot more details will come out in the coming months. I'm sure they'll have a media conference pretty soon, and we'll bring details of that on the show. But for right now, a very exciting schedule, and I'm sure you and I will sit down and figure out when we're going to head out there and hopefully try to have yet another annual event like we did the last time.
Absolutely.
Dzień dobry, nazywam się Sabina Gadecki i ty słuchasz do Anti-Up.
Okay, I hope I didn't overhype this hand of the week at the top of the show. But this is one of them. Quite a bit of detail here. And I got done reading it. I was exhausted not only because of the level of detail that our new good friend Cornell Lawrence put in this, but just where he is as a player and what he's doing listening to us.
Well,
I think my actual response was, you're definitely on a different level. So I hardly feel justified in offering any analysis. Now, of course, that's probably what I should respond to, the way that writes to us. But Cornell here, I'm not sure where he comes from, but he played this actually at the Garden City out at San Jose.
Okay.
Where he says, probably displays Anti-Up magazine in the room.
Yes.
Appreciate that. But yeah, I'm not going to invite him to our Anti-Up home game.
All right, well, I'll take this time to remind you that we're about an hour and 15 minutes into our show, so let's do the Cliff Notes version of this hand of the week, maybe.
All right, well, we'll try to do it as quickly as we can here. All right, it says, this was the late-night free-roll frenzy at the Garden City Casino San Jose.
Okay.
A series of $250 buy-in tournaments with a couple different No Limit Hold'em formats. This hand occurred in the $250 No Limit Hold'em $100 single rebuy tournament, where you started with 8K and starting chips, 8K and rebuy chips, and you can rebuy at any time during the first four levels.
Okay.
We're in the fourth level, 100 and 200 blinds, no antes yet. It folds to the player to our hero's right, under the gun plus two, with squeakly 16,000 in chips, who open limps to our hero in the low jack position, and our hero looks queen of hearts, queen of diamonds, and has a stack of 20,300, no squigglies necessary.
Oh, okay. Let's raise it up to 700.
That's exactly what he did.
All right, yay!
Yeah, standard raise, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it sounds about right.
3x, 600, maybe make it 800 maybe. If you get the extra guy. But 700 is fine, right?
Yeah, I think so. Sure.
All right, he gets called by Mr. Big Stack on the button, squiggly 35,000 in chips, and the under-the-gun player. Blinds a fold, 2,400 chips in the pot, three-handed.
Okay.
See, we're moving right along. We're already to the flop.
All right.
You haven't even made fun of the hand or anything.
This is, was this the subsection one? I can't remember where we are on then. We got to get the whole flow chart next to the hand.
Yeah, well, I've got Ross Perot working on
okay.
designing that for me, so... Next week, a little bit more organized on the new flowchart. All right, well, he's going to give us a couple reads on his players here before we move on to the flop. He says, the player to his right was relatively new to the table and was an alternate that got in at beginning of level 3, played pretty conservatively, open-limped a few hands. Can't remember too many hands where he raised, but he wasn't playing a lot of hands. Doubled up semi-recently, and when he flopped a set against a player of top pair, if I would put him on a range to start, it would be small pairs, deuces to eights, weaker Broadway draws, and suited connectors.
Okay.
All right.
Yep.
Mr. Big Stack, which he calls MBS for. See, people are shortening things up. It's great.
Trying to help us out.
Mr. Big. Mr. Big Stack, I feel pretty good playing against this player. He was at my starting table in No Limit Hold'em Shootout earlier in the week in this tournament series, which our hero won, by the way. Had to find a way to slip in a brag, he says. Sure, why not? Because I played against him in a shootout, I got to see him play a lot of hands. I felt really comfortable with his game. Anyway, he had a pretty tight range. He appeared to play rather tight. even though he was on the button, he's not a type of player that would call with garbage and try to steal. Figured he would call with deuces through nines, ace-jack plus, king-queen, queen-jack. I think the worst connected hands he would call with is jack-10 or 10-9. What's wrong with jack-10? he says he's really that tight. No, really. Also, he got involved in a few pots early and had to use his rebound. Needless to say, he made a heck of a comeback. A couple players kept trying to bluff him up. He kept snapping them off. All right? So he's a tight player with a lot of chips.
Okay.
this is what Cornell thinks his image was. I've been hemorrhaging chips for the last three levels. I have been looking at a bunch of napkins and couldn't find any good situations to pick up some chips. I was down to 7,025 and went on a bit of a heater. Got all into king-king pre-flop and doubled up. The next hand I had jack-jack, flop top set, and a short stack shipped it to me with jack-10 to no avail. Jack-10! That's a great hand!
Not anymore. It's not when you have top set against it.
The hand we're discussing is the next hand. So I've just raised three hands in a row. The table got to see my king-king and jack-jack. I would think I still have a good image, but raising three hands in a row always raises suspicion. I still have my rebuy available, and have the second biggest stack on the table. So yeah, I mean, what do you think about? I mean, obviously you're not going to not raise with kings, jacks, or queens, but it's kind of odd when it happens three hands in a row, right?
Yeah, it is. And then I think you have to adjust your play accordingly too. People might not be respecting your raise the third time, so you might be up against a lot worse hands than. Even though this guy's tight, he may be thinking, all right, look, I'm the big sack at the table. I'm not going to take any crap from this guy. So maybe that call of a raise doesn't necessarily have to mean a really big hand because of the fact that you raised three hands in a row. I know you showed down the kings and the jacks, but really, I mean, what they probably think you're riding the rush. So
just keep that in the back of your mind. Yeah, because remember, people are suspicious. They can't imagine that you're going to wake up queens here again.
Yep.
All right, so back to the hand. The flop comes seven of diamonds, five of hearts, four of diamonds. It's check to us. I remember the second act, so the end of the gun, plus whatever, check to us, and then we have the button, Mr. Big Stack, behind us.
Right. Okay, well, I have no reason to not bet here. I mean, I have every reason to bet, actually. Very coordinated board, both with suits, and even a possible straight is out there, though it's highly unlikely. I'm going to bet two-thirds of the pot a la Lee Childs, which is, let's see, 20, so about 1,600.
Wow. See? You and Cornell joined at the brain.
So sorry
to tell you that, Cornell. All right, you bet 1,600. I like that bet as well, too. Obviously, you got a bet here and, maintain what we're going on, and two-thirds of the bet, two-thirds of the pot, the way to go, right?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, Mr. Big Stack, remember our tight guy on the button, raises to 4,000. He says, yeah, that's right. Mr. Conservative is getting pretty frisky. He says, when I see this raise, I'm thinking that Mr. Big Stack is thinking the following. One, he thinks I have a hand like ace-king and totally missed. Two, he has a small pair and wants to see where he's at. Three, he has a set and is afraid of the flush draw.
Okay. Well, I don't think he's afraid of the flush draw. It's very likely he has something like eights. Or nines or something, because I think eights or nines in a tight player like that would call a raise preflop and wouldn't re-raise with it.
Exactly.
Right? And then if he had a set, I'm not really afraid of 6-8, given that we've been raising with big hands every time we've raised, and even if it was suspicious, I doubt we'd be raising with 6-8. So
unless O'Malley's playing.
That's true, unless O'Malley, of course O'Malley would fold when we re-raise, so kidding O'Malley. I feel like I think we're still ahead here. I just don't know if I should just call and keep it small, or I guess it depends on what the under the gun guy is going to do now too. I can't really react yet till I know what happens there. But to me, I feel like we might still be ahead here, because I feel like if somebody has kings or aces and they're that tight, they would have raised preflop. So the only hands that we're really losing to are a set of sevens, fives or fours, and would he really raise with a set of sevens if he's that tight? I mean, I just don't think he's been playing scared, so maybe he has, I don't know, but I have a feeling that we could still be ahead here and that he's not respecting our hand, especially since it was the third straight raise preflop. I think I might pop it again. I don't know. I mean, I'd hate to just call and then have like an ace fall on the turn or something, and I'm not being resolutory or defeatist either. Right. I feel like the proper play here is if this guy's really tight and he thinks that I'm. See, I can't. I'm trying to narrow his range here, but I just keep putting him on something that could even be.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I'm not worried about the ace falling in because I think you kind of mentioned this a little bit, but I would be surprised if this player did not raise us with aces or kings.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I guess he could have ace-king, but, you know, when it's raised three times in a row, you see that, I think that, yeah, I mean, I guess he could. But more likely, I think you're right, he's in that eights to jacks range.
Yeah, and I just meant, when I meant by ace falling, I mean, not that I'd be afraid he has the ace, but that it would kill my action.
That's true. That's true.
What I think is that he has, like, an eights or a nines hand, and if he does, God, I guess if I knew he had that, I would call. That's the thing. You know, it's so hard.
Well, just ask him. Excuse me, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Big Stack.
I'm quite in a pickle here. Do you mind just revealing your hand? It would really help my decision-making process. Thank you. Kisses, Scott.
Let me ask this first. Do we know, did the under-the-gun guy plus whatever fold?
We got a lot of discussion here. Let me skip ahead and see. He does not say, but there is not a third player at the turn, so it's, I guess he does fold.
Okay, all right, so we are heads up. I guess that could be tricky and call here.
But we don't know. Yeah, we do know. Yeah, that's right. He probably folded before that.
But there is something to be said that if this guy does play something like Jack 10 or, like you said, two big Broadway cards, and they're suited diamonds, I think he could raise there with two overs and a flush draw. So I think we're still ahead then, and I think that we need to. All right, I think ultimately I'm going to re-raise again. I'm going to raise this guy again.
Too. Remember, we have a little Geico insurance chip here, right?
Yeah.
The rebuy. We still have our rebuy chip. We started this at 20,000, right?
Right.
I'm not saying we just want to spew off our 20,000 and rebuy, but we do have a little bit of insurance, right?
That's a great point.
So here's the thing. I don't like getting crazy with just one pair, an overpair, usually. I did that at that Immokalee tournament, got lucky.
Yep.
And rivered it. And I knew I shouldn't have done it to begin with. So, though I have that insurance policy, again, it's like the Formax, or it's the Omaha. I feel a little more emboldened to do what I should do, and I shouldn't be so scared about that overpair and worried about whether he has a set here. Which is the only thing that I think we has a beat, because I don't think aces and kings are a likely roll, right?
Right.
So yeah, I'm going to raise here. Again, I don't want to dump my 20,000, but I feel pretty confident that we're ahead right now, and I'm going to raise, and if I'm wrong, I've got two more cards to come where I can catch up, and if not, then I can rebuy, and I'm good to go. It's a different situation when I don't have that safety net.
Was that in the email somewhere that he intended on using it if he needed to, or that it was just an option?
No. I'm just saying we have it. You know, yeah. He mentioned that he still has it. So,
well, if he said that, you know, he had an extra buy-in with him, and then he would use it if he went broke, then I would definitely go a little more with his.
Well, I see what you're saying, but he did mention at the top of the hand that he still has his rebuy chip. Mentioned that if you weren't.
Okay, so that means he probably will use it. So if he needs to use it, he will. It's a great point.
Yeah. It's a $100 rebuy. You pay $250 to get in. It's one of those kind of ridiculous things, I think. Why wouldn't you?
I'm definitely making it probably $12,000. And I know some people will probably say you should just call here, give him a chance to bluff out on the turn if you check to a, you know, like a offsuit nine or something. I don't know. But I think that even a jack, I feel like this guy could have something like eights or nines, and he just doesn't believe us because we had three hands in a row, and he's pretty tight, so he might think that you know he's tight, so you get on some different level of thinking there, too. But it could just be very well be two overs that are diamonds, and either way, I think we're ahead, and we need to push this a little more. So I would raise again.
And you're right. Here's the thing about the 12,000 that I like, too, is, you know, you make that bet. Normally, you would say you're pocket committing yourself then because it only leaves you 8,000 behind, right?
Right.
But you got that rebuy chip. So you can make that bet. You know, if you really think we can get this guy to fold, or there's a good chance we can, or get him scared, and we win the pot, that's great. And if he plays back at you, if he re-raises, then I know I got to be in trouble, right?
Yeah.
I can fold knowing that I can use my rebuy chip get 8,000 more units. I'm back to 16. I started the hand with 20. I only lost 4,000 on this hand, plus the safety net. Yeah. I'm not saying that's not anything, but you know, you got a possibility of making that bet, which is a pretty good bet, and still getting away from this hand without calling off the rest of your chips.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too, is I don't know the rules behind the rebuy chip. Does it have to come out when you're under 3,000 or something, or can you use it whenever you want?
I thought you said any time. any time during the first four levels.
Okay, terrific. So you could, but again, you can use any time.
Well, yeah, it doesn't say specific.
Specific levels. But okay, let's just say he could do that. Then that makes it even more.
You're right, that would make reason. A difference. Yeah, yeah, it has to be below something. Well, usually it's below your starting stack, which is 8,000 here, so.
Yeah,
so if we bet 12,000, we'd be right around that.
Right around that. So yeah, so maybe calculate. Okay, I'm gonna bet enough to put me at 8,000, so that I know if I lose,
79.99.
Do the Scott Long bet online where your stack looks massively huge because you put a 9 in the bet somehow. But no, really, I think that given all of the parameters, given that this guy didn't re-raise us, he doesn't have aces or kings probably. So I think I'd make it 12 grand.
All right, here's the thought process. He doesn't think two pairs in our opponent's range. I think he likely has threes through nines. I think that he would have raised me pre-flop with tens through aces. If he has, I think that's, I don't know about tens and jacks.
Yeah, I don't know about tens and
queens,
jacks.
Kings, aces, but you know, that's fine. He says if he has 3, 3, 6, 6, 8, 8, or 9, 9, I don't want to let off the hook and raise out a worse hand. I wouldn't allow him to continue to bet with a worse hand. I mean, thanks to protecting his hand against the flush or an ace or king. Makes sense. My plan is to call the flop and check call the turn. I've decided that if I would not be afraid of the flush if it comes, because I don't think a flush, he has a flush draw. The only cards I believe I'm afraid of are the ones that further straighten the board, such as a 3 or an 8. Also, I think calling allows me to try to keep the pot from getting more out of control against one player who can bust me. I don't like raising here because I think I would be way ahead. Way behind any hand in his range that would call, and it seems kind of spewy. New word, I like that.
Spewy.
I don't believe folding is an option either because my hand is just too strong. I can't be afraid of monsters on the bed, right? So he calls, and we have 10,400 in the pot.
I think the monsters under the bed was supposed to be subset 4 under post-flop analysis, and when he missed the mark there. He should have put that in there somewhere. All right, well, like I said before, I think calling is a little tricky. But it puts us at a tricky spot. You know, he could be right. The guy could have pocket sixes, and he's open-ended, and that's why he raised.
Yeah.
So that would really kill us if a 3 or an 8 came on the turn. It would really kill our action, and then we'd have no idea where we are at that point, whereas now I think we could be safe in thinking that we know our opponent doesn't have a straight. I don't like eliminating the flush draw from the possibilities. If he said that he would call a raise with paint, then why wouldn't he have paint here? That and I would raise with ace jack of hearts here. Oh, I'm sorry, ace jack of diamonds here. If it was on the button and I didn't believe that you had it every single time, three hands in a row. So I don't like that. I don't like eliminating those hands. But I do like the idea that he has a hand that's worse than mine right now, and I don't know. The problem is that you can't really put him on the actual hand that's worse than yours to decide whether or not a call is correct here. I like a call because it keeps the pot a little bit smaller. But again, what are you going to bet on the turn if it's a blank? And,
yeah, I think you're almost going to have to check on the turn, right?
Yeah.
And let him get a free card, which you don't want to do, or let him dictate the size of the bet. I mean, if you just call here and you bet out again, what if he raises you again?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty scary.
It's tough to play this out of position.
If you don't raise post flop, then when if you're check now, you're literally giving him two free cards or two cards at his price.
Yep.
You know, because now if you're going to check the turn here, and if he checks behind, now you've given him the river free too. So it's like the you know, the Lee Jones limit hold'em in position raise and get the free card thing.
Yeah.
So I mean, obviously it's no limit, but it's the same premise. So I just don't know if I liked that check or not. I really think I need to bet there before the turn. And I'm sure that people will find their own ways to say that's not the right move, and a call isn't a good move. But I feel like I need to raise here.
Well, and I'm not going to belabor this too long, but he does mention the one player that can bust me. Again, I think there is some value to raising and not feeling pot committed here because you have that rebuy chip. So I'd hate to take away that that possibility because you're thinking you're pot committing. You're going to have to get it all in.
Yeah.
He re-raises.
Yeah. I mean, and I guess the raise, they'll basically put your cards face up that you literally are telling him, I have an over pair that's in Broadway's, you know.
Or a set, I mean.
Or a set, but yeah.
I mean.
But maybe a set be more inclined to slow play. But yeah, I think
but
that we are
too, putting hands. If this guy's really tight, I mean, my re-raising him has got to tell him, hey, I know you're tight.
Yeah.
And I've got you beat here.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to raise unless you have something. My something is better than your something.
Which,
if he's really got the right read on these people, and, you know, completely different if you're doing that against Gus Hansen.
No, the other thing is that I wonder, you know, when you're literally telling him, okay, I literally have aces, kings, queens, or a set here. If he has pocket sixes, he may call that re-raise because he knows that if a three comes, you may shove, and now he's got you drawing dead.
Yeah, but then you're down to one hand at that point. I think
when you raise,
it doesn't necessarily mean that you have overpair. You could have a set here. You could have a straight. Unlikely, but you could.
Right.
I mean, he doesn't know what you have. He just knows that you think you're really strong because he's a tight player.
Okay.
And that way I'll know. If he raises again, then I got to put him on a set.
Yeah, if he raises me again.
He's not going to four-bet me without a set there.
Yeah.
And then I can let it go.
Yeah, this reminds me of the whole leverage chapter from that that tournament poker book that... So it is definitely a leverage situation. I feel like the raise is the right thing to do because you're telling him it's going to cost you your whole stack now to re-raise me or to see my cards. So I still like the raise. I just don't like the call there.
Yeah. All right. Well, the turn is the tray of hearts. So our board now is seven of diamonds, five of hearts, four of diamonds, tray of hearts. And our hero says, just peachy, sigh.
It's a bad card.
Yeah.
It's a bad card because it's going to get us into trouble. Because we still have a huge overpair, so even if he had the hands we were putting him on earlier, which were eights to even jacks, the sixes. The sixes is the only hand that this kills us for. I don't know
or
if he has threes.
Too.
Yeah, I just don't see him calling with pocket threes. Well, let's see if we had re-raised.
And raising
with threes. I see him calling with threes. I don't see him raising
right,
with threes.
You're right. I'm going to eliminate threes. You're right.
Yeah, so maybe sixes because it's an open and draw I would raise, but... And now, so really, pocket six is the only hand that this hurts us,
but it also puts another draw up there. Yeah.
Hard draw. But it's going to get us into trouble if this guy really does have us beat because it's yet another undercard. It's not like it's an ace or a king that kills our action or slows him down.
I will say, too, it does give us some split outs, too.
Hmm.
I mean, if he's got pocket sixes, I mean, it's a two-outer, obviously. If he doesn't have sixes, if he has aces or kings or something like that, or something else, or, you know, instead of fives, fours, like that, we could catch one of the sixes and split, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a little extra protection.
This is why I don't like the call on the flop, because now we've given up control of the hand. What do you do now? You bet now after just calling his raise? You're going to check, and if you check any bets, now what do you do? Now you're like, well, it changes nothing if you don't put him on the sixes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a finite hand. And 3-3, I just can't put him on 3-3 after that re-raise of my bet out. You know, you would think that if he has position on you, has threes, and he thinks you have ace-king, he's just going to call and, you know, float the turn and then take it from you on the turn. He's not going to re-raise you with threes, I don't think, especially at such a tight player.
No, you're right.
So, I'm gonna be sick about it, but I'm probably gonna bet out here because I just don't see that three helping him unless he has pocket sixes, obviously. So,
but here's part of the hand of the week template that it's so true and so hard. I mean, I don't think we would have called
right. Either
of us. So, putting us in that situation, that's tough to say what you do now because we really wanted to bet, we really wanted to raise on the flop.
Yeah.
But it's weird to call a raise and then bet out when a tray of hearts comes on the turn, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I
think by the fact that we called on the flop means we have to check now.
Yeah, I know. If
and
we're playing
check
in
now,
his,
it sucks
his shoes,
because now he's going to bet whatever he wants, and then we got to figure out whether our single pair is good.
Yeah. I know. All right, so we're playing it through his hand, and the way he played it, and we have to each take each situation new to ourselves. So
I got to check now.
Yeah, now I have to check, I guess. It's so brutal. That's why I would have raised.
And really, to be honest, now I'm hoping that he checks behind, and then a safe card, whatever, I don't even know what a safe card would be now, comes on the river, and then I can feel confident calling his river bet.
Right.
That's what's tough about being out of position and playing it this way.
Yeah, I guess I agree with you. We have to play it in his shoes now. And in his shoes, we're facing a 10,000 chip pot or so, and we gave up control of the hand, and we have to check here, I think. It's just sad. I know Johnny Chin has a move where he'll call with a big hand when somebody raises him, and then he'll bet out on the turn to totally throw the person off.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting play.
It is. I mean, it could work. I mean, against a tight player too, you could confuddle him, and you could bet. I mean, what's your right bet here? I mean, it's 10,000. So
yeah, 6-5. But the other thing too, seven.
Try to get away with 3 even to save some money and see if it just confuddles him.
And you could be representing the sixes there too now yourself. You know.
Yeah.
Just
I'd almost like to bet
sense.
A little bit. I'd like to bet 2 or 3 just to kind of give that air of mystery to him. That you know, hey, I just hit my straight, and I want you to call.
Yeah, very interesting. That's a very interesting line to take because now it makes sense. You could raise with sixes, 3 hands in a row, riding the rush of kings, then jacks, now pocket sixes. You could bet out when you see that flop because it's relatively safe, and if anything, it's great for you because only 1 over, which you don't really put anybody on a 7, and then now you're open-ended on top of it. So you could actually take the line that I have
very
sixes,
well. Yeah.
And then I just called your raise on the flop because I'm wary that you might have an over, but I have a draw, so a call is necessary there. So now you're taking the line that. So yeah, maybe you're representing sixes on top of it, but you still have a good hand on top of it too.
It's
only
true.
A bad
yeah,
hand.
True. So
maybe you can bet here. I don't know. God, I would either.
And I think you're right. You can get away with betting a smaller amount too if
yeah.
you're trying to sell that line, which is good for your hand right now. We really don't want to commit a lot of chips to this hand right now, not knowing where we are and thinking we could be behind. If we can control the pot here, put 3,000 in here and. You know, 5,000 next, or even check the river and really confuse him.
Yeah, because for us, if you bet like 3,000, it looks fishy to him. It looks like it's you want to get paid off, and for us, it's defensive when we want to get
right.
our queens
exactly.
to showdown.
Right.
So maybe you do bet like 3,000 to 5,000 here. I don't. I just hate the check because I didn't want to be in this position.
Yeah, yeah. See, I think I talked myself out of the check now when I was thinking about it like that. Now I wish I had the time to really think that through at the table, and I don't spend that much time.
Yeah, I don't think that.
My instinct obviously was to just check there if you'll defeat it.
Yeah.
But I think that small bet is the way to go.
All right, well, let's agree then. What, 3? Anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000?
Yeah, I'm going to bet 3. I think 2 is probably too little.
Yeah, that's kind of 1/5.
3 is like, you know, hey, I want to get paid off. And, you know, hopefully it'll just call.
Yeah, it's a third of the pot, about
yeah.
a little less than. So, all right, so let's bet 3, see what happens.
All right, well, our hero checks.
Ah, damn.
Which is, you know, our original line. So.
Right.
And Mr. Big Stack bets 6,000.
Oh, man.
Yikes, our hero says. And yeah, that's the problem again going with the call there. Now you turned over the control of the hand. Now he's. That's a good bet on his part, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He took control of the hand and he thinks that you have ace king now. That's exactly the line he's taking. He thinks you have ace king. And he doesn't believe you, so it doesn't matter what he has, but I'm still believing he has, like, eights to, you know, whatever, jacks. And he doesn't believe you. He doesn't think you have yet another big, you know, Broadway pair. He believes you have ace-king or maybe even something like eights yourself because you called his raise or that you have ace-king hoping to hit one of your overs and then mm-hmm. Could bet out. But since you didn't bet out and he doesn't believe you have sixes then, that's probably why. He probably thinks you have ace-king or a flush draw.
All right, well, our hero says, I really don't like this turn card because now 2 more hands in this range have got their threes and sixes, though I think we've
eliminated threes.
The missed of threes. I still believe he thinks I have ace-king or a flush draw protecting his hand, and I can still beat 8-8, 9-9, and 10-10. I still believe my read is correct, and he would not call raise preflop with a hand that would make 2 pair on this board. Also, if I shove, I might lose him because I think my hand would look like a big overpair, and he would only call with a set or a straight. I think that's smart.
Yeah.
My plan is to call and then check call on most rivers if he bets. On the river, I think I would call any paint or flush on the river. The only river cards that I think I should be concerned with would be an 8 or 9 if I stick with my read.
I believe this player would only bet the river with a set or better. That's good information to know. Also, if he has a hand that big, it should be a reasonable river bet that I can call. If I call this bet, I have about 10,000 chips left, plus my 8,000 chip rebuy, with squiggly 22,000 chips in the pot. I think this player's a bit of a showdown monkey, and on the river, I think he would check back two pair or worse on this board since the board is so wet. He definitely doesn't seem like the type of player that could extract thin value on the river. Since I anticipated he would check back most often and not fire another barrel, I call.
Well, that's interesting information to have. I wish I'd had that. You know what I mean? If I knew that the guy, even if a pretty decent hand, is going to check the end, you know, I wouldn't be so weary of checking to him then on this turn. I didn't know that information going in. But we checked. He checked. We would have bet, but he checked. So I'm calling $6,000 and seeing what happens, I guess. You know, just because sixes are in this guy's range, yeah. It feels to me that he's in his range.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can justify the six now if you think there's a high probability that there's not more money that has to go in on the end unless you obviously hit your queen.
Right. And
you, but
like
most
you
players
said,
don't play like that. I think most players, you know, are gonna a tight player is gonna, you know, fire yet again.
Like you said, I guess we do still have sixes as an out if we need it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, then what happens when he shoves and it's straight to the seven on the board?
Well,
he has pocket eights. So,
yeah.
So I don't really count it as an out, but it's something that might scare him.
I counted it as an out when I thought we might end up all in before the end.
Yeah.
but this guy's a showdown monkey. I'm gonna have to get Robin at PMS to do some showdown monkey t-shirt. all right, so anyhow, our hero decides to call. He says he thinks it makes his hand look pretty strong, like I have an overpair. I don't believe that he would think I could continue with two overcards unless they were diamonds. Well, I think that's probably right, too. I can't think that he would think you're that stubborn to keep calling off all your chips with ace-king or ace-queen or something, right?
Right, and I also feel like this guy, if he's as tight as he says, this bet here now eliminates him having a flush draw. Because I think if he was that tight, he would not bet $6,000 with a flush draw on two overs. I think that now he would say, okay, I get to see the river for free. Hopefully this guy doesn't have pocket sixes and trap me. And if he does, let's hope my flush gets there and I can get some money out of him because he has a straight, is what Mr. Big is thinking. I don't think that – I don't think he has a flush draw now. I think he literally has jacks, tens, nines, eights, and maybe sixes because he's protecting against a flush draw. But I think that we're ahead here, but I don't mind calling because I think that it's keeping pot relatively manageable and not costing us our entire stack in case we're wrong. So I don't mind the call there.
Yeah, a lot of chips in the pot, too.
Yeah, it's a big pot. It's big enough.
Yeah. All right, the river is the eight of clubs, of course, our hero says. So our final board, seven of diamonds, five of hearts, four of diamonds, tray of hearts, eight of clubs. Not safe for word expletive. There was one card that I didn't want to see in the river, and that was it. Who didn't see that coming?
Well, I don't know. Why? Because you're putting them on exactly 8-8? I mean, what's the difference? The straight got there with sixes anyway. Eight, is he really going to have 9-6? Or, you know, I mean, so what is it because you're worried about a set of eights? That's highly unlikely. I mean,
You're right. But, I mean, it is. Deuces would have been nice there, right?
No, I understand. But I'm saying he made it sound like it's the absolute. He said there was one card he didn't want to see.
It's actually a deuce wouldn't have been good, too. That would have been pocket aces straight as well, too.
Yeah. Not that he has aces.
Yeah, I mean, I guess really, you didn't have a lot of cards that weren't going to raise a flag here for you, right?
Yeah, very few cards don't make you go, You know, if it's a jack, you could have had jacks this whole time. Ten, you could have had tens this whole time.
Anything in the between, anything under that makes the wheel draw.
Yeah, yeah.
Deuce, and aces and kings. I mean, obviously, you're already dead anyhow, but maybe it saves you some money.
Yeah, I don't really care about the eight.
Yeah, that's what's really interesting. I didn't think about this when I first read it, but there wasn't a card that we wanted to see here other than a queen.
Right. Right, we want to see a queen. But even that, you still could be losing to a hand. That's the thing.
Yeah.
I like the eight, to be honest with you. I maybe he has eights, maybe not. But he was talking about checking and calling, so I don't know. I think I would bet here. I mean, again, I have all unders to my board. I don't think he has a six. If he has eights, I want to see if he has eights. Maybe if I put a defensive bet out there, he might just min-raise or something and I can get away with it. If he shoves, then I have to reassess. But I like to bet here, actually. I don't want to check call again unless I absolutely know this guy likes to show down hands, like he said. So if he likes to show down hands, maybe I check and let him, you know, show his hand down, and we say, oh, could have got more money out of him or whatever if he shows like a pocket nines.
Well, speaking as an experienced type player here, I'm the type that would probably check behind if I had pocket eights here. Which is weak, I totally admit, but I'm just, I don't know what you have, and I am more relieved because I made that 6,000 bet and you called. I'm like, gosh, daggone it. And now I hit the card. Now I'm happy. I exhale and say, hey, I hit a card that's probably going to win this for me. I'm just going to be happy I hit that card. I totally admit that that is an extremely weak way of looking at it, but you have to understand a type player thinks that way.
Yeah.
And if this is a guy that's a showdown monkey, like he says, and probably isn't going to bet here, I'm not so worried about that. I could probably still check, and he might check behind, and then it doesn't cost me anything on this street.
That's a good point because, well, I would feel that way if I were aggressive, not tight. Maybe I would think about checking because this guy could be walking the dog with me the whole way, right, and he has pocket sixes, right, and he's made it straight, and he's just letting me bet myself into the hole. But since I am a tight player and he's just calling, I don't know if... Now I'm thinking that this guy, you know, I don't know. I don't know. If I hit 3-8s on the end there, I don't know if I... Maybe I am checking behind, but it feels like it's... If I'm taking it from the villain standpoint the whole way, I feel like this guy, you know, had a draw that didn't get there, or he had an over that didn't get... That is not beating me now. So I think I would put a value bet in, just because we played it.
And I will totally say that when I make this play, when I weekly check behind there, I almost always feel that I had the best hand.
Yeah.
So I almost always know that I'm giving up value, but it really is a psychological thing. It's, man, I've been walking this tight wire, I don't know what this guy has, and now I got some backup, let's just shut down and be happy with the pot we have. And again, it's not optimal at all, but I mean, when we're talking about the hand of the week, you got to think about the different types of players out there. And the way that the guy has described this guy to me, it sounds a lot like me, and I know I'm capable of just checking the set of eights there.
Yeah.
As bad as it is.
Oh, brutal. Well, all right, let's go back to we're in the shoes that we're in here. I like to put a defensive bet out. I mean, I just, what if I check and then he shoves? What do you do then?
Well, yeah, I mean, we got 10K left, I guess, right, after we made that call, right? We still got the 8K, which, going back to what I said before, if we would have raised to 12K, then we're in better shape than I would have been then, so we could fold here. Seems funny, though, to come all this way in the end and have an 8 come and then fold.
Yeah, and I guess at that point it'd be 4-1 on your money because it'd be 40-something thousand in the pot.
Although I guess I'd rather not put all 10K
33 to 1, really.
In case I'm wrong.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I guess if I thought there's a bet that I could make that he would call, again, maybe the 3,000, that sounds pretty crazy, though. I mean, that's nothing.
Well, I mean, I like a defensive.
But I guess you're going to decide, though. Don't you have to decide right now before you decide what you're going to bet whether you're going to commit all 10K of your chips?
Yeah, because there's already 22 in the pot. Changes. If he shoved on you, there'd be 30, essentially 30 in the pot because you can only call 10.
Yeah.
So you're getting 3-1 on your money with an overpair. And unless you believe he has sixes or eights, which is very, very minimal, you know, you're really narrowing his range to two exact hands, you might have to call again 3-1 on your money with an overpair there. I just hate to call and be wrong. And you do have the insurance of having $8,000 left over if you know, with the buy-in, so...
Well, I guess my question about deciding whether you're going to go all in or not here, I think if you decide that you are going to put your chips in regardless, you might as well just put them in now, right?
Yeah, you might as well just shove now.
It's 22K in the pot. This guy's been wrong the whole way. He's not going to call 10K here?
Yeah.
And if you don't want to put all your chips in the pot, then that's a different story. Then I think you got to pick a bet size less than 10,000 that you think he'll just call and not raise. And whatever the lowest amount is, you can do that. If you think 3,000, he'll just call, then 3,000. If you think it's 5, then 5.
Yeah, the other thing, though, is if I put 3 in and then he shoves, I can't fold anyway at that point.
Well, that's what I'm saying. 7,
so there is no number, decided. I guess. Yeah.
Right.
So I guess it's either a shove or a check.
Yeah.
And then check call. I mean, it's such a bad position we're in that wouldn't have gotten there had we played it differently, but we can't. This is where we are. This is what we have to do. So, I don't know. I like to bet here, so I guess I'm shoving.
You're going to have to shove here, right?
Yeah, I guess I'm shoving. Which is so weird considering how he played it the whole way. You know, he called on the flop after his, you know, the raise, and then checks and calls, and then shoves. And he's afraid of the eights, you know. It takes a lot to shove there.
Okay. All right, well, our hero does check, and Mr. Big Stack does the worst thing ever and moves all in. How rude! our hero says he totally didn't expect this from his player, and I started to tank. But yeah, I guess you let yourself believe that he's going to show down here, so we just check and thought I'm going to free, and didn't think about the fact that he might. And I guess we didn't have a plan for what happens if he did, right?
Right.
But again, you're right, it doesn't really matter. I mean, check or shove was our two options here, so now we just got to decide whether we're willing to put our last 10K in and rebuy for wrong, or surrender and, you know, know that we have this 8K chip in our pocket. Again, it'd be nice to know whether we could just buy it without any requirement.
It's so bad to say call now, because if you're willing to call 10, why wouldn't you put it in? That's the thing. You know, if you're going to call this, I mean, maybe you've gotten something to read on the guy in this last, the way he shoved his chips or something, but that's so rare. I mean, it's so bad to check call all in here. If you're going to go all in, why didn't you shove anyway? I mean, unless you really believe that you're ahead. And if you really believe you're ahead, then you would have put a bet out. So, oh man, it's so bad. If I checked and this guy shoved, I would have folded. Because there's no way that I check call all in. If I believe I'm ahead enough to make a call of an all in, then I believe I'm ahead to shove all in with, right, with getting that much of my money. So, if
and
I
a smart
did
player
check,
would figure that out, right? You would look at, hey, there's 22K in the pod. You have 10K left. You're either committing your chips, you're not here.
Yeah.
If you check, then there's a good chance that the shove here is going to get you to fold because you decide you may not want to put those chips in.
Yeah. And I have to keep remembering that we have that buy-in too. That's, we can still keep playing. I just feel like I have to make a bet, and if I don't make a bet, then I'm basically giving up the hand. I mean, unless you are on that level where you're thinking, I know what he has, and I know what he thinks, because if I check here, he thinks I can't call a bet, and that's why he's shoving. But this guy is just so tight, I don't think he's playing on that level. I just feel like this guy is playing big hands and getting lucky with them that they're holding up on him, and he's built back his stack up, and he's not very creative. And I feel like he's just got his, I just feel like this guy has, like, jacks or something, and he's going the whole way with them, and he doesn't believe you. He thinks you had a draw. But if you had a draw, why would he bet here? What's he betting? He's only going to get called by a better hand. So maybe he has nothing or whatever, and he's trying to get you to lay down the best hand. I don't know. I just don't know if he thinks that way. I just feel like if I checked, I'd fold. But if I was going to put any money in the pot, it would have been a shove.
Yep. All right, I think it's fine. Our hero says, I was a bit surprised by the shove because I thought he put me on big cards like Ace-King, and there's no way he can get any value from Ace-King with that bet.
Yeah.
Very true. I initially put him on a small, medium pocket pair, and now I'm beat by 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, 7, 7, and 8, 8. The only hand I think he could have that I could beat here is 9, 9. I guess it's possible that he could have 10, 10, or Jack, Jack, but since I just reached three hands in a row preflop, I would expect him to get 3-bet preflop. Again, I think I'm not so sure about that. But,
yeah, I don't know about tens and jacks doing that. But
he says, I did show jack-jack and king-king both times I raised, but who would believe I have another big hand at that point? I sure wouldn't. No, either would I. Most players wouldn't. I think he would raise me from the button with a hand like 10-10 or better preflop, so at this point I really think I'm beat. Then he starts to talk to me unsolicited. He says, do you have an overpair? I respond that I think it's pretty obvious what I have. Oh, I like that. It's pretty obvious what I have. He then says, I have a bigger overpair than you do. To which I respond, that is not possible. Oh my, did he really get a really flat call preflop on the button with Jack-Jack and thinks I could have 9-9 or 10-10? And really, 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 no, really, wanted to call after this statement. The hand, combinatrix. Wow, that's a new word. Combinatrix. I'm going to try that on a word. From my read, told me there are more combinations of hands in his perceived range than that have me beat than what I can actually beat. He also looked extremely confident that he had the best hand. Also, I don't think he knows that I'm capable of making a big fold in the spot with a hand like ace-ace or king-king. And I don't think he's creative enough to try to make me fold ace-ace here with a big bluff. With the break approaching, if I fold, I will have squiggly 10K in chips and my 8K chip rebuy, which would give me 18,000 in chips. So I guess that answers the question. You could rebuy it anytime.
Okay.
The next blind level will be 200, 400 with 25 ante. With 18K, I would still be above average in chips, and I don't have to go into do or die short stack mode, which I'd have to do with only 8K in chips if I'm wrong. No, you wouldn't. Read my book, Short Stack Ninjas. But if I win this pot, I am the big stack, and I have a good shot at making a decent run in the tournament. Decisions, decisions. Eventually, I decided to go with my original read of his likely hands and fold. So gross. I thought I had a good plan for the hand, but that plan went up in flames, and I just jumped ship. Sigh. During the break, I approached Mr. Big Stack and asked him if he bluffed me. He said he thought I had ace-king, of course. And then he had 10-10. Somebody shoot me.
Yeah.
He said he planned to shove the river on any low card. He justified his play, stating that he would only call my raise preflop with a real hand, again like I expected. I really hope he was lying, but I believe he was telling the truth. So, Andy of Nation, what do you think? Be nice with a little smiley face. I thought I liked my plan when I was going through the hand because I had such a good feel for my opponent. Against another player, I probably would have gotten it all in the flop since I had the other players covered.
Yeah, I think the misread of his opponent really is what hurt him, because he felt that he would show the hand down. So that's what, you know, if we now shove, does he call any shove, any card with a shove? I don't think the guy does. I think he thinks about it. He may have called there with tens because they're all, you know. But really, the only hand he beats now is nines with tens.
Yeah,
so if you do shove, you put him to a test, and he's only putting you on one hand because he can't beat any other hand, really, any reasonable hand.
Right.
So I think the misread of this guy liking the showdown, being a showdown monkey, is that what he... I think that hurts him a lot. And, of course, I think what we talked about earlier was I don't think he played it right on the flop. He talked about that he would have shoved... or something. What did he say about he would have shoved on the flop? I don't know. He said at the end there, you said something about against another player, he would have gone all in.
Oh, yeah, but, shoved on the flop.
Yeah. But again, I have no problem re-raising there because 7-5-4, two diamonds. Really, if this guy's as tight as he says, aces and kings, he would have re-raised. So other than that, no other hand really is going to beat you there except sevens or fives or fours.
Well, here's what's really interesting, because this is the part of the Roman numeral six where we go back and go, oh yeah, a lot. All right, on the flop, I was suggesting that we raise to what you said, 12K or so.
Yeah.
And then knowing that if we get called, then we have the option of shutting down because we still have enough chips plus a rebuy to go forward. So had we done that, it's hard for me to imagine the tens are going to fold to that raise, right?
Right.
So then what do? Now we both think that we're in a pickle. So using my line of thinking, I would probably check on the turn and slow down. And then I don't know what the tens do at that point.
Well, I think the re-raise could make tens fold, though.
At the same time.
I don't know, though. You think that you call with tens on a re-raise after he raises and then re-raises you? So he bets, you raise, he re-raises you. You still think your tens are good there?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think I would, especially if the guy's as tight as he says. Now, again, we have to go by his read, not ours. But
yeah, you're right.
His read has made this guy so tight, I think he folds to 10s there. And if he doesn't fold to 10s, then we have to bet out on the turn. Because we're showing strength. We're saying we have aces, kings, or queens. And if the guy calls, you know, does he really have a set? Because if he has a set, he's gonna think we have aces or kings and can't lay the hand down. He's going to re-come over the top of us, and we're going to get it all in with him. So he's going to want to get all of our stack there with aces or kings or a set. So I really feel like the re-raise gets him out of the hand or defines his hand.
Hmm. Well, here's the overall thing is I think, as I said at the top, I think Cornell is on a different level than I am, and which is great.
Yeah.
I think in this particular hand, I think he probably overthought it.
Yeah. And that can happen.
Yep. Oh, yeah, easily. And I guess it's better to overthink it than underthink it, which is what most people do. So not critical at all. But I think if you look back at the hand, that's what I'm taking out, is that I think he overthought it and got himself in a situation where he got too scared and folded.
Yep, totally agreed. And I think a lot of people listen to Lee Child's lessons or read his columns, a lot of them do say, don't think everyone's on your level. If you're a much better player than your opponent, play on his level and think what he's thinking.
Right.
And don't give him too much credit, too, if you know that that's the way they play.
Excellent. Well, great, Hank Cornell. We appreciate it. We are going to be happy to send you a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for the Apple products from Smapsoft. Don't overthink that game. but you don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store.
All right.
And send your hands of the week and other comments to podcast@andyupmagazine.com.
That's right. Hey, I'm feeling better. It must have been the hand of the week that made me feel better. I actually made it to the end of the show. I'm glad for that and glad for NyQuil. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Logg.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.